Yeah.
Here.
Here.
Here. Thank you, Donna. Let's see, public communication. We want to open it up. So I see no one here or coming forward. We're going to close it, and then we're going to move into our closed session items tonight. Can you cover those, City Attorney?
Certainly. Honorable Mayor, Council members, it's the intent of the Council to meet tonight in closed session on five items. First one is public employment, the position of the City Manager. Second one is conference with labor negotiators pertaining to represented employee group, Grover Beach Police Officers Association. Next one is conference with labor negotiators pertaining to management of confidential employees. Conference with legal counsel on existing litigation, and that's Santa Maria Valley Water Conservation District versus City of Santa Maria. And lastly, conference with real property negotiators for the Pacifica, pertaining to the Pacifica companies and the state property. The closed session will begin when we recess to closed session, and it is likely that these items will be continued till after the regular meeting.
Okay, and then I just wanted to confirm the business item number one. Did we state a specific start time for members in the public?
6:30.
6:30? Right. Okay. So then please let the record show that Councilmember Wright is here.
Thank you.
Good to see you. I think at this point we will recess into closed session.
Thank you, Mayor.
We're going to reconvene the. Can everyone hear that? We're going to reconvene the special meeting for the Grover Beach City Council on Monday, November 30, 2015. We just concluded a closed session, and I'm going to ask the City Attorney to give a report on that.
Certainly. Thank you, Honorable Mayor, Council members, members of the public. The Council did meet in closed session on items 1, 2, and 3 as depicted on the agenda. There were no reportable actions taken by the Council. Items 4 and 5, the two remaining items, will be taken up with Council's direction at the end of the meeting.
Very good. Thank you, City Attorney. All right, let's move into our business part of our agenda tonight. This is item number 1. This is a status report on water supply and recommendations for additional action. Public Works Director and City Engineer Ray.
Mayor, yes. We're going to start with Jim Gehring. He's okay. Going to review the status of the our water sources for you. As you know, he's got a lot of expertise in the area.
Very good. And before I turn this over to Mr. Gehring, I want to allow the Mayor Pro Tem Lee to make a statement. So you have the floor.
Thank you for that. And I basically just wanted to make a quick announcement that in past history, I've needed to recuse myself on many issues regarding water, specifically Zone 3 items. And I just wanted to make everyone aware this evening that I no longer have that conflict, and so I no longer have a need to recuse myself on Zone 3 items or other water-related items regarding that issue. So I just wanted to, before we started tonight, if there's any questions from anyone, so with regards to that.
Great. Thank you for sharing that information with us. So now, Mr. Gehring, it's always good to see you. So
Mr.
I'm going to
Mayor,
turn the floor over to you.
Members of the Council, the Mayor, thank you, and it's my pleasure to be here again tonight. It's been some time since I've been before the Council. I'm here to talk a little bit about some of the areas that I'm familiar with regard to Grover Beach water supply. And I think I'll start right in with an exhibit. I thought this exhibit was fairly informative. This exhibit came from Scientific American in the August 2015 issue. And it's a plot of climatic conditions in the state of California, starting in 1895 and going up to the present, to 2015. So the author plotted things like reservoir levels, rainfall, soil moisture conditions throughout the state of California. And you can see that there are a number of different colored areas of the state that he plotted these different data points from. And each little colored dot on this chart is from one of these areas of the state represents wet or dry conditions. The median condition is down the center line. And if we get into the upper zone here, then we're on the wet side, and then on the lower zone, we're on the dry side. So you can see that beginning in 1895 and going through what were the Dust Bowl days in the Midwest, we had a peak, a wet period in around 1975 to 1980, and then the state as a whole, all the regions of the state, the trajectory turned in a downward direction. So that we've been in a dry cycle for roughly about 30 years. And that's in spite of the fact that we've had several El Nino years during that same period. For instance, 1998 and 1997 were both quite wet, and yet, in spite of those years, the dry cycle and the downward trajectory continued. I'm just going to take you back a little bit to the mid-1960s. In the mid-1960s, the city of Grover Beach and other contractors contracted for Lopez Water, and some of the reasons that were used to decide to contract for Lopez Water were that there was recognized a potential for seawater intrusion. There was an episode in some of the Century wells that I'll show you a little bit later that showed some high chlorides or some salt coming into those wells. And in addition, the shallower groundwater had high levels of nitrates in it. So, and that turned out to be a health problem. And for those reasons, as well as future needs, the city and other agencies in Zone 3 decided to contract for Lopez Water. Looking at Lopez, there's a picture of the lake. And the safe yield of Lopez is divided into two categories. There is the urban category of 4,530 acre-feet a year. And then there's the downstream release of 4,200 acre-feet per year. And of those two, of course, Grover Beach is an urban contractor and has 800 acre-feet of entitlement water. Every now and then someone asks me, are you still releasing water from the base of the dam downstream? And if so, why are you doing that during this drought where we're so short of water? And it turns out there are some good reasons to be releasing that water. One of those was that during the time when the dam was being considered, the agricultural interests were concerned because the dam would have a clay core that would go all the way to bedrock, and that clay core would seal off the underflow or water flowing in the creek gravels past the dam site. So even though in, for instance, pre-dam days when the creek was dry on the surface, there was water flowing underground in the gravels of the creek. So the dam was going to cut that off. So part of that downstream release is to replace that underflow water. Another purpose for that downstream release is for environmental purposes in the creek. Today we have endangered species in the creek, and so there's some desire to preserve habitat and enhance habitat for endangered species. And as well, there is a reason to release water downstream because it provides for well recharge, not just in the upper Arroyo Grande Valley, but clear down into the lower Cienega Valley, and in fact helps to recharge the city of Grover Beach, Arroyo Grande, Oceano, Pismo Beach wells. So a lot of good reasons to be releasing downstream. But, you know, we've been in a drought, and if you haven't realized we're in a drought, here's a picture of Lopez Lake in the spring of 2013 on the left. So here's where the windsurfers would normally be out there going back and forth in their windsurfers. But in 2015, by the early part of this year, you can see there was a great decrease in the amount of water available. For those that might have swum or had been swimming at Vista Lago swim areas right here, well, today it's a long ways to water. So how are we doing in Lopez? Taking a long view, when the lake came online in 1969, we had one of those rare El Nino years. There were projections that the lake wasn't going to fill for 5 years when it came online, but we had one of those very rare El Nino years, and the lake filled clear to spilling in one very, very, very wet year. Looking at this chart, there are some things that are really kind of important to grasp. One of them is that The lake has a capacity of 50,000 acre feet, as shown here. So when we see levels above 50,000 acre feet, the lake is filling over the spillway. This period that I'm circling with the arrow, that represents the time between 1969 and 1987, the first 17 years of operation of Lopez. And during that time, Lopez Lake spilled 12 times. But now, look at the next 29 years. In the next 29 years, we only spilled twice. So you'd have to say that whatever your thoughts on climate change might be, it's been drier for the last roughly 30 years or so. We had thought that the period between where I have the arrow here, 1987 and 1995, was the drought of record. But now we're seeing a new drought that started in 2011, and we've been on a downward course ever since. I would mention that recently the Technical Advisory Committee to Zone 3 and the Zone 3 Advisory Committee developed what is called the Low Reservoir Response Plan. And that was approved by the Board of Supervisors several months back. And that plan is a plan to operate the lake at low levels to preserve water supply for as long as we can. The trigger point for the Low Reservoir Response Plan, as shown on this exhibit, is at 20,000 acre feet of storage, basically 40% of lake capacity. So at 40% of lake capacity, 20,000 acre feet, the Low Reservoir Response Plan is triggered. It was triggered in March of this year, and dry conditions have continued, as you know. This red line represents what we believe will be the trajectory of Lopez Lake if dry conditions continue for the next year and a half or so. We are currently about where I have the arrow, just below 15,000 acre feet of storage. Taking a little bit closer look at the last year of Lopez Lake, here again we have the green line being Lopez Lake storage levels dropping below 20,000 and the low reservoir response plan being triggered. Here we are as I sit here today at about 14,800 or so acre feet. And if we get average rainfall over the next year, or the next winter actually, the lake will recover somewhat, as shown by this dashed green line, up to about, perhaps 21 or 22,000 acre feet. So we will recover to above the trigger point for the low reservoir response plan if we get average rainfall for the rest of this season. On the other hand, if dry conditions persist, then we can expect the lake to continue to decline somewhat as shown in this dashed red line. I'd mentioned that these outline blue bars represent rainfall amounts for each month that would be average. So I don't know if I can read that. It's a little over 2.4 inches in March would be an average. So if we get those values, we can expect it to recover, but we would likely fall back below the trigger point for the low reservoir response plan by early next year. Looking at the low reservoir response plan and how it treats municipal deliveries, when we hit 20,000 acre feet, as far as municipal deliveries, there was no reduction in deliveries to municipalities or municipal contractors. That delivery rate stayed at the rate of 4,530 acre feet per year. But when we hit 15,000 acre feet, there was a 10% reduction, a mandatory reduction in deliveries to all of the agencies, and that would represent delivery at a rate of about 4,077 acre feet per year. So that is the status that we are on today. If, in fact, we hit 10,000 acre feet, there will be an additional 10% reduction in deliveries to municipalities. And if we are unfortunate enough to hit 5,000, a full 35% reduction. And if we're down to 4,000 acre feet, at present we think it's going to be difficult to get any water out of the lake without some extraordinary measures. Looking at the downstream release side of the low reservoir response plan, when we hit 20,000 acre feet, right away there was a 10% reduction in downstream releases from 4,200 acre feet a year down to 3,800 acre feet per year at that rate. That rate was determined by meetings with the agricultural community as well as the technical committee to see what would be best for them in terms of the rate of reduction of downstream releases. And the ag community, in essence, they wanted to be front-loaded so that they could get enough water as long for a definite length of time that they could plant crops and depend on the water. And after that, they recognized that we might not be able to release nearly as much water. And as shown here, by the time we get to 10,000 acre feet, if we do get that low, over 75% of the downstream release water will be curtailed. It's sobering to think, and I'll be talking about groundwater in just a second, but it's sobering to think that if we do hit 10,000 acre feet of storage in Lopez, or even lower, we will have to curtail downstream releases as shown. And that not only affects the agricultural community, but the environmental conditions, the endangered species, and it affects our ability to recharge our wells. Because it's necessary to release at a certain rate, upwards of over 3,000 acre feet per year at that rate, for it to reach the lower valley. If you release lower than that, then that water, much of that water, does not reach the lower Arroyo Grande Valley. So just taking a little bit more detailed look at the trajectory of Lopez, taking into account the last 4 years of rainfall conditions we've experienced. We've had 4 years that are all dry, but there was a very dry year and a not-so-dry year, a wetter of the 4 years, I guess is the best way to put it. If we're able to, or if we do get rainfall equal to the wetter of the last 4 years, then we're likely to follow the green line, and we will have water in Lopez out until perhaps March of 2019. On the other hand, if we get rainfall at the rate of the driest of the last 4 years, then we're likely to see Lopez in a condition where it's going to be difficult to get water from it by March of 2017, hardly a year and a half away. I would mention that the goal of the active management character of the low reservoir response plan is to, as we approach these very, very low levels, to be able to ensure for as long as possible that we can deliver health and safety water, water that we can fight fires with, water that we can flush toilets with and wash with, but not very likely water that we're going to be able to water lawns with. So I'm going to leap from that into groundwater a little bit. Just to refresh the council's recollection, you'll recall that we are part of the Santa Maria River Valley Groundwater Basin. It's an entity of three management areas that was created as part of the groundwater litigation that was started in the mid-1990s and was settled in 2005. So we're the Northern Cities Management Area up here. Below us to the south and east is the Napomo Mesa Management Area. And here is the Santa Maria Valley Management Area. It's useful, I think, at council level to visualize how the basin basically works. There are inflows of water to this overall groundwater basin. The Sisquoc River, the Cuyama River, the Los Barros Creek, Arroyo Grande Creek, Pismo Creek, and a number of smaller creeks all flow into the basin on the surface and in subsurface flows. In addition, of course, rainfall falls in the basin. And when the basin is healthy, groundwater rises up in the basin to an extent where it will flow towards the ocean and push seawater away from the coast. It's a fact that you have to have fresh groundwater above seawater elevation, above sea level, so to speak, to be able to have that water pressure push salt water away from the coast. If you don't, then seawater is more dense than freshwater, and it will tend to start migrating inland if it's the same elevation. Taking a little bit closer look at the Northern Cities Management Area, here we are, Grover Beach, in the Northern Cities Management Area, and you can see we've got the southerly part of Pismo Beach, Grover Beach, Arroyo Grande, Oceano, and agricultural interests to the south. You may recall that in 1983 there was the gentleman's agreement that your council reaffirmed in 2002, and that gentleman's agreement and reaffirmed agreement had provisions to operate what we thought of as the Arroyo Grande groundwater basin on a safe yield basis. So for the last 30-plus years, we in the Northern Cities Management Area have operated our portion of the groundwater basin on what we believe to have been a safe yield basis. And out of that, the city of Grover Beach was given an entitlement which amounts to today of about 1,407 acre-feet per year. It's perhaps useful to realize that groundwater for Grover Beach at 1,407 acre-feet per year represents not quite two-thirds of your water supply, the other third being Lopez. I would mention that the groundwater litigation settlement of 2005 allowed the Northern Cities Management Area, us, to continue to operate our segment of the groundwater basin on those same safe yield numbers that were developed back in 1983. Looking a little bit more closely at how we manage our segment of the basin, there are sentry wells or monitoring wells, four of them along the coast, one up here where I've got the arrow between North Beach Campground and Pismo Coast Village, another at the State Beaches and Parks Maintenance Facility, another on Pier Avenue, behind the liquor store on Pier Avenue, and then one far south on the beach, one at the relocated Oceano Railroad Depot parking lot, and one over here on the boundary between the Northern Cities and the Napomo Mesa Management Area. As a management area, we monitor water quality, water elevation, and trends in all of these monitoring wells, or sentry wells as we call them, on a quarterly basis, and they're internally reproduce a report every quarter as to what the conditions are, and then every year we report to the court on what we think the conditions are in our basin. I went over this briefly before, but this is a stylized diagram to illustrate how seawater or saltwater intrusion can occur. In the upper part of this exhibit, it shows freshwater under the land at an elevation above seawater. And so, therefore, there's a zone where the two mix, but it's generally out to sea and away from our wells. If the elevation of freshwater on land falls down to sea level, then there's the potential for seawater to push in and mix with freshwater and contaminate wells.
May I ask a quick question to clarify?
Yes, sir.
Certainly.
So,
please interrupt me anytime.
The interface, that is where the saltwater, where it mixes with the freshwater. Is that what the interface is?
That is what is thought happens. That there is, if you go further seaward of that, then you're in basically saltwater in the groundwater basin, and landward of that mixing zone, you're in freshwater.
Gotcha. Thank you. Thank you.
So here, this exhibit is a plot of deep well key wells along the coast that we monitor on a quarterly basis. This plot starts in 1967 at this end and, of course, goes to 2015 here. It's useful to think of these high points, these sawtooth high points on this plot, as being spring groundwater elevations, and then a point like this is a fall groundwater elevation. So we see groundwater rise and fall with the seasons because of inflow from creeks, underflow, and rainfall. It's one of the things that got the technical committee's attention was this period between 2007 and 2009, where the average deep well index was quite low, just a couple of feet above sea level. And it's, what happened was in October of 2009, one of our sentry wells, the well behind the liquor store on Pier Avenue, started to show rising chloride levels. That's an ion in the water. When you think of chloride, think of sodium chloride, common table salt. So when we see chloride rising as an ion in water, we think that we're beginning to see the start of potential seawater intrusion. In this case, it only happened in one well, but it was of considerable concern. By the spring of 2010, groundwater levels had risen up and the chloride levels had gone way down. Just as an example, the background chloride levels were about 50, and during this episode, they rose up to 700 and then fell back to about 50 again in the spring of 2010. What we're worried about today is this trend of falling groundwater levels at the coast, and we've had one, two, and now we're looking at 3 years again at very low levels. So we're watching water quality levels in these wells very closely. This diagram, I don't expect the council to interpret it, but I wanted to describe to you how we go about looking at things sometimes. You're quite aware, I'm sure, that you can do a contour map of the ground and develop ground contours for grading and to see which way the water runs and how to build driveways and so forth. This is a contour map of groundwater elevations. So these contours on this map, which are in 1965, show groundwater elevations under Grover Beach in this area and out to the southeast corner of the Napomo Mesa in this area. Taking that diagram and this one, which is in the fall of 2014, I was able to develop this diagram. So to interpret this diagram, here where I have the arrow, we are at the Grover Beach well field. This is the surface of the ground. I put a bunch of little stylized fir trees to show you that this is the surface of the ground. So we're at, on what's called the Arroyo Grande Plain here, and we drop down into the Cienega Valley where all the farming goes on, and then we climb up onto the Napomo Mesa to an elevation of about 300 feet, 320 feet above sea level. In 1965, groundwater elevations throughout this whole zone were represented by the red line. So you can see that there was quite a gradient between the southeast corner of the mesa and the ocean to provide for flow of groundwater towards the ocean in 1965. The orange line is fall of 2015. And so we had a pretty good gradient at the far southeast corner, but by the time we get into the area around Cypress Ridge and Woodlands, groundwater is 10 feet below sea level as of fall of 2015. And it's at or below sea level for quite a ways in this general area. So that's very worrisome. I'm just going to jump back now to this one, to the fall of 2015 groundwater contours. And let me trace this contour for you. This contour that I'm tracing is at zero elevation. In other words, that is at sea level. So groundwater within that entire area, this whole area here, about 12 square miles is at sea level.
Hey, Jim, I don't think we don't see a cursor.
Oh, you don't?
Mm-mm.
I'm sorry. Okay.
There we go. Is there a mouse?
Can you run the program?
Okay. Let me go where I can point. I'm sorry. I didn't know I wasn't making sense.
Oh, you were making sense. It's just this part I knew was going to be tough.
Okay. So are we on here? Okay. So this whole area here, right here, that whole area is at sea level or below. And this area right here is at 10 feet below sea level.
Yeah. Wow.
In the fall of 2014. Now, if you go back as recently as 1999, where I have the dot, where in fall of 2014 water was 10 feet below sea level, there was a ridge of fresh water running across this area that was 50 feet above sea level in 1999. So there's been a great decline in groundwater elevations under the Napoma Mesa, and it's a serious, serious concern to us at the technical level because water will tend to run downhill. This water in the ocean out here is heavier, and it's above this water. So we're concerned that we're going to see, unless conditions are reversed, seawater intrusion, and we're watching for it very carefully. Okay, next slide. And next slide after that. I might need my notes. Next. So with that, for everybody to worry about, I wanted to talk about state water for a second. There are some aspects of state water that it would be useful for the council to grasp well, and that would be that back in the 1960s, the county of San Jose, the county, contracted with the state of California for 25,000 acre feet of state water, and ever since, the county has been paying for that entitlement for the operation, maintenance, and capital costs for the Central Valley Canal. So we have, as a county, 25,000 acre feet of entitlement, but the ability to transport that much water generally stops in the Central Valley Canal. When we built the coastal branch and it came time to sign up agencies in San Luis Obispo County for state water, only 4,750 acre feet were subscribed to and became entitlements to various agencies in the county. And within our area, within the northern cities, Pismo Beach contracted for 1,240 acre feet and Oceano for 750 acre feet. Next slide, please. So how's the state water project doing? Well, if the county had been able to access and transport its 25,000 acre feet, these are the amounts it could have transported to the county in these years. So only the years between 1996 and 2000 was 100% of the water available. The low occurred in 2014 at 5%, and 2015 is the availability is about 20%. And you might think, well, that's really bad for state water contractors in San Luis County. But it turns out, as you think about it, if 20% of 25,000 acre feet is available, there's 5,000 acre feet available. And everybody who has entitlement to state water in the county of San Luis Obispo in 2015 could have gotten their full entitlement. Mm-hmm. So it's useful to keep that in mind. Without exceeding our contractual capacity in the pipeline. But let me give you one more scenario to think about. And that would be in a 50% year. San Luis Obispo County can get 12,500 acre feet. We only have capacity to transport about 5,000 of that, except that Santa Barbara County has an entitlement and transports through this county 43,000 acre feet in a 100% year almost. And in a 50% year, they only get 21.5 of that. So there's all of a sudden, paradoxically, in a low water year, all of a sudden there is capacity available in the state water project pipeline to the Central Coast to transport some of that 25,000 acre feet to the county and to other agencies, or to do things like recharge the Paso Robles groundwater basin or recharge the Napoma Mesa Management Area groundwater basin, things of that nature. All right, next slide, please. I think I'm done. Oh, I wanted to touch on how we've been doing and what's been going on in terms of the management area. The management area peaked in 2007, I think that is, at about 9,000 acre feet for the whole management area. But by 2014, we're down to 6,800. So by 2014, we'd already achieved over 24% of reduction in water use in the management area as a whole. And Grover Beach has been doing better than that, and I think Mr. Ray may mention that. What is really significant, though, is that in the groundwater arena, in 2007, we peaked at about 3,400 acre feet of pumping out of a entitlement of about 4,300 acre feet. But through conservation and using other sources of water that became available, at least temporarily, in 2013, we only pumped 1,000 acre feet of groundwater, primarily for the purpose of trying to limit the risk of seawater intrusion. So I'm hoping that that makes some sense to the council. I'm going to summarize briefly that both Lopez and groundwater are at historic low levels, and that is why your council has been requiring conservation from all your citizens, and all the councils and boards in the management area have been doing the same. There is some thought that an El Nino year might turn things around completely, and certainly an El Nino year will help. But if you'll remember that second slide where the trajectory for the state was in a downward condition, there were several El Nino years in that downward trajectory. So one El Nino year or two all by themselves won't reverse course. They will help, but not reverse course. So that summarizes my presentation. Any questions? Otherwise, I'll turn over to Mr. Ray.
Great. Thank you, Jim. And stay close by. Let's see if there's any questions. Councilmember Nichols, do you have any questions?
No, not at this time.
Okay. Councilmember Shaw.
No, that was very informative. I don't have any questions at this time. No, I don't think so.
Councilmember Bright.
Yes, please. I just have one or two. Now I start to sound like Mayor Pro Tem. I have one, two, maybe three.
I'm giving everyone an opportunity before him.
Going back to your slide number 9, the low reservoir response plan, I'm just wondering if we get to that 10,000 acre foot, or even, God forbid, the 5,000, how is that going to affect, what would be the effect to the HCP or the attempt to get that habitat conservation plan done?
Well, I don't believe it'll have a significant effect on completion of the HCP, although it will give us some additional data that we can present to the resource agencies to show them why we're going to want to be lowering releases during certain conditions.
Okay. So you don't think that would cause it to be a delayed or?
I don't know, unless Mr. Ray's got a thought on that.
I don't see the schedule of the HCP really being necessarily tied to enactment of the LRRP. So.
Okay, great. And then my one last question is regarding the state water issue. When you say that the county has an entitlement of 25,000 acre feet, but we can't actually get it all here, my understanding was that if you were to subscribe to the state water, you had to pay for it. So, and you pay for your water whether you get it or not.
That's true. It's very similar to Lopez water. You pay for it whether you get it or not. The cost of the unallocated state water, that is, and I didn't go into this in any detail with the council, but in addition to the 4,750 acre feet of state water that is actually entitlement water, contract water, there is about another 5,000 acre feet of state water that is what is called drought buffer water. So that water is also obligated, leaving an unallocated amount of about 15,000 acre feet. If you have an entitlement to state water, the only extra cost you would likely pay to access the unallocated water is the O&M costs for the Central Valley Canal, which is actually relatively low, and I could be mistaken, but I think it's at around $100 an acre foot extra.
Okay. So then folks who have not, like Grover Beach and Arroyo Grande, at least in this area, are not subscribers or whatever we call it, we don't have entitlements to state water. How would we could we ever access it if we needed it?
In some respects, we're accessing it now because the Board of Supervisors has made extra state water available to the zone in the past as drought water.
Right.
And it comes to us in the form of, I guess I can't get into it. It's too complicated to explain.
Okay. All right. But so in the event that it's we're in really dire straits, then there will be some ability to access that water if it's available.
At present, it's the policy of the board. I'm sorry, it's the policy of the Public Works Department to do that, and it's the unadopted policy of the Board of Supervisors to do that, to do just that. The costs of doing that are up in the air.
Mm-hmm. So nobody really knows, but okay. All right. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. The presentation was excellent. Thank you.
Great. Mayor Pro Tem Lee.
Yep. And Jim, don't go too far. But Karen asked most of my questions, so it will be exactly nicely done and shorten up the amount of time that I'll ask questions. So, but I did want to piggyback off of one of her questions regarding participation in state water. If we did go down that path, and maybe this is a question for Mr. Buckingham, but is there not a process where the city could opt into state water, whether it be through the EIR process? Were we in the original EIR, or as an interested party, or what level of review would be necessary for that? Yeah, any idea?
I don't know the answer to that question.
Okay. And then actually,
it's possible that an environmental document would be required, though, for the city to actually contract for state water.
Okay. Gotcha. Then, actually, my other two questions just had to do with just some semantical questions. On slide 7, that's the slide where Lopez was filling under its dashed conditions, and you anticipate about 1.4 inches of rain in November. Did we get there? So do we know what the rainfall was in November? I don't think it was that high. And so, in effect, we're behind already, correct?
We are behind already.
Okay.
I would mention that I keep track of rainfall out of my place. In the last El Nino year, for October, at my place, I got 4 inches. And this year, I didn't get anything. So I'm worried.
Okay. And then if we go to slide 6, actually back one slide, the low reservoir response plan was triggered at 20,000, and then you're estimating the potential with little or no rainfall projections of reaching the 10,000 acre foot mark in April of next year. The water year, if I remember correctly, for Zone 3 is April to April. So what's the planning for allocations for next year? How is that being handled?
Well, I'm not sure I'm going to answer your question, but keep in mind that the low reservoir response plan is not releasing water on an annual basis. It's releasing water at the rate of a certain amount. So when you're at 10% reduction, for instance, that rate is at 10% reduction, but as soon as we hit a next lower level, it's reduced. So the rate reduces. And you may not receive, for instance, if you have an entitlement to 800 acre feet, you may not receive it because you're mid-stride and not reduced.
Okay. Hmm. So towards that discussion point, though, is this year, this water year, we had 800 plus the additional 10%, or we had 10% reduction, but that was made up by the surplus water, for lack of carryover water, sorry, the appropriate terminology.
Right.
In effect, we had, what was it, 860 acre feet. So the likelihood, though, for if we trigger the 20% reduction, we're going to go all the way down to 740.
Plus some carryover.
Plus some carryover.
The exact carryover is right now.
Okay. So if we don't get rain, the anticipation is that our 20% reduction actually is going to be greater than 20% because of the carryover water. I don't know if I'm representing that correctly.
Actually, it would really be the opposite. Your entitlement water under the low reservoir response plan is reduced by certain percentages, 10 and then ultimately 20%. But by having water in storage, you could deliver that water at the same during the same time period. So, if you were reduced 10% and let's say you had 10% additional in storage, if you wanted to receive water at the original rate, you could receive water at your full allocated rate. Of course, you would then eat up the water you have in storage. But that option is available to us.
Which then begs the question, how much do we have in storage?
I hate to say I don't have the exact number off the top of my head, but it amounts to... I can't think of it. It's... Yeah.
Yes.
If memory serves me correctly, isn't it slightly more than 300 acre feet? Right?
I'm sorry. I think the number sounds right. I think it's actually slightly less than 300 acre feet, but it's somewhere between 270 and 320 acre feet in that range. I'm thinking back to when we were doing the study, and I can't remember what the final outcome was.
Okay. And maybe the question that where we go there is with the amount of water that we have in storage, even if we get to the 20% reduction, the storage could hold us upwards of our 800 acre feet for 2007 or for the next water year.
Right. So in the remainder of this report, which I do have some additional information to cover, I do go over that. We anticipate about we could survive for about 2 years on Lopez supply.
Okay. Great.
Okay. So then I'm going to hold my questions because I do want staff to kind of go over. It looks like you've got in the staff report some recommendations. So can you highlight those for the council and the community?
Following up with the information that Mr. Gehring provided, and first I'd like to thank him for that providing that information, and he's been an advocate for sound management of our water resources for quite a long time. The city, I think, has benefited significantly from his advice. I think you heard the information that he presented. With record low levels in both sources of supply, we have what could be a long range drought prediction, or even possibly the norm that we should expect for. Predictable future would be lower than typical rainfall. We do have potentially a short-range critical condition. You saw that groundwater levels are, in fact, below sea level in certain areas, and that there appears to be a landward gradient. These are all of great concern, obviously. I think it's imperative with this information in hand that not only do we continue the long-range planning process that we have been engaged in, both through the Northern Cities Management Area and through our participation in Zone 3 Technical Advisory and Advisory Committees, but we also need to continue to work toward developing a solution for a short-term supply. And so with regard to the short-term supply, options that have been considered to date would include interties with other agencies. Of course, we have the storage in Lopez Lake that's been developed through the through what was the surplus water program initially. We have the current conservation program, but as a short-term solution, if for example, we saw saltwater intrusion, we could instigate very severe restrictions from our conservation standpoint. The county is contemplating a water project using desalinated water from Diablo Canyon. And then, as Mr. Gehring mentioned, there's a potential through the county to purchase some portion of state water on an emergency basis. And I think these are all options that we should consider. The Zone 3 Technical Advisory Committee put together a list of recommendations and a ranking for short-term supply solutions. That was vetted with the Zone 3 Advisory Board, and that recommendation was forwarded to the county and with a request that the county take a lead role in developing one or more of these emergency supply solutions. And more locally, I think what we have available to us at hand are some existing interties, actually, both with City of Rio Grande and the City of Oceano. And some of those other cities around us also have similar interties, Pismo Beach, for example, with the City of Rio Grande. Those interties could also provide an emergency water supply. If, for example, we need to deliver more Lopez water at a much higher rate than we can currently receive. Looking at the long term, you know, beyond the potential of some kind of a critical supply problem or perhaps seawater intrusion, again, we do need to develop a long-term supply solution. And these are the kind of projects that take a great deal of time to develop and complete. I have mentioned on the slide between 5 and 10 years. And, you know, projects that have been considered so far include desalination. There have been a number of studies here on the coast. There was a study regarding raising the spillway elevation at the Lopez Dam to provide additional storage. Of course, currently that's not of much benefit. Possibly purchasing a permanent supply of state water, otherwise becoming a project enrollee. And one or more recycled water projects, which we'll talk about later on in another staff report. Conservation, we can't forget that conservation is also an additional source of supply. And, you know, current conservation mandated under the Stage 3 condition, which was a 10% mandated reduction in water use, has saved the city in the neighborhood of 700 acre feet of water, which is substantial considering our entire Lopez entitlement is 800 acre feet. Council could consider, if necessary, to address a long-term supply condition or situation. They could consider making the current mandated conservation a permanent requirement, which would hopefully reduce our dependency on current supplies and possibly extend the reliability of those supplies. And again, there are two recycled water projects being studied currently. Both could be considered as potential regional water supply projects. They include the City of Pismo Beach Recycled Water Project, and you heard a presentation on that from the City Engineer Public Works Director, Ben Fine, who I believe, yeah, he's here in the audience tonight. So if, when we get to that item later on, if you had questions, he's potentially available. And also there's what's called a scalping project being considered in the City of Rio Grande. That a scalping project would essentially intercept wastewater on the way to the South San Luis Obispo treatment facility and provide treatment and tertiary treatment of that water for possible reuse. And then also, finally, in our long-term supply solution, be aware that the Zone 3 Technical Advisory Committee is encouraging the county to study the Diablo Canyon desalination facility as a permanent supply instead of an emergency supply solution. And there's good reason for that, is that the potential startup costs of that, capital costs initially, would probably be prohibitive for a short-term project. It would make much more sense to pay those over a longer period of time. There are some fiscal impacts that need to be considered. The report you have in front of you touches on them briefly. You know, if the city experienced a short-term water supply emergency, it would require funding to implement an emergency supply project. There currently isn't sufficient funding in the Water Enterprise Fund to allow for a significant project, much beyond an emergency intertie, or if the county could supply emergency state water. Even that is at an unknown cost right now. The city has some potential sources of funding. They do include the Water Fund Reserve. The city could consider an emergency funding source such as a loan. Or if necessary, we could resort to the general fund reserve in the case of an emergency for short term. The council could consider enacting an emergency rate adjustment, but as you're aware, rate adjustments are slow to take effect. So ultimately, we may need to consider one of the other options. Looking more long term, you know, in the 5 to 10 year time period, participation in any of the regional supply projects, for example, the recycled water projects, would likely require a significant allocation of funds, and that would be primarily to pay for the initial studies, design, and permitting process. It's likely that the capital costs would be would be spread over a period of years of the project and be included in the water rates themselves. But the city would need to allocate funds in order to be able to participate in any of these major regional water supply projects. The city could pursue grants or loans to help fund the initial costs, and I'm certain that any of these projects are considering the same. So either the city could, the project proponents, such as the city of Pismo Beach, may be pursuing grants or loans to reduce the cost of the project, but ultimately we may have to individually pursue grants or loans to fund our participation in the project. And then, again, in order to reduce the impact on ratepayers, the council may need to consider developing a capital reserve fund, a specific capital reserve fund within the water fund. I note that council has directed staff to prepare a water rate study, and staff is recommending that the rate study consider development of long and short-term water supply solutions, as well as the ongoing effects of conservation and drought. So those are my general recommendations relative to the water supply condition. And as Mr. Gehring also mentioned, we're both available for any remaining questions.
Okay. Anyone have any questions of Mr. Ray? Anyone to my left?
No, I don't right now.
Okay. Mayor Pro Tem?
Two additional questions, and I think you kind of alluded to one of them with regards to the utility rate study. Can either you or the city manager kind of give a time frame for when that's anticipated to come back to us?
I had, Mr. Mayor, if I could, I'll answer that. I'd hope to have it done by early in this calendar year, but it's been delayed due to other workload issues. I expect that I will have a consultant on board to conduct that by next month. So it would probably return within 60 days following the retention of the consultant.
Okay. And then as part of the first quarter budget update, you'll kind of let us know how the
we'll update you. I can tell you that as the council is aware, our cash reserves were slightly over $1 million in the water fund at the time that the year began. We anticipate that because of the reduction in revenues due to conservation in the neighborhood of 15% to 25%, that we will be eating into that. How fast we eat through it will depend to a certain degree on what capital projects we take on as well. But it's likely without further adjustment, will you eat through the majority of that by the end of the fiscal year?
The majority of the
reserves? Funds, yeah.
Thank you. Sorry.
Triggered a question, huh?
Mm-hmm. And
you have anything else?
Just one other question. It has to do with kind of what our neighbors are doing. I know we've heard from Mr. Fine and other folks with regards to conservation programs and so forth, but can you just kind of give a brief synopsis of what Arroyo Grande or Napomo or the other jurisdictions are doing that we might want to incorporate or might be beneficial for us in the community?
Well, there's sort of two levels to that question. On the long and short range supply side, I note that the cities of Arroyo Grande and Oceano Community Services District have both committed to some level of participation in the recycled water project currently being studied by the city of Pismo Beach. I would also note that both cities have been developing a capital reserve fund to provide for an additional supply of water in the future for participation in a project or independent development of an additional supply. And then in the very next staff report, I do touch briefly on some of the other agencies' considerations relative to their water conservation program. I would mention that several cities have brought up the idea of a moratorium, but no one has to date determined that that was necessary. And then relative to the MESA, as you know, the county has a permitting authority for projects on the MESA, and there are a number of different types of water suppliers on the MESA. Some of them are actively engaged in water conservation. Others, it's difficult to tell specifically what they're doing. So we also know that the Napomo MESA has started, and they have successfully achieved a very small part of what is to be a supplemental water project that ultimately would provide an amount of water identified in the settlement agreement as required to be provided. But we also know that they do continue to be in overdraft even with that water supply. So.
Okay. Great. Let me start with Jim. Thank you for that very thorough presentation, and I know you showed a lot of really good information regarding water-based and safe yields and whatnot. Has an actual comprehensive regional hydrology study been done of the area?
We have not completed a model for the groundwater basin as yet, and that is one of the major goals of both the northern cities, the county, and the Napomo Mesa management area. There has been an intermediate study done, characterization that I believe is complete, but that will be part of the main model when the time comes.
Okay. Any time frame on that, Jim?
As yet, I don't believe we have a funding source for the model.
Okay. And then I know Councilmember Wright brought this up, and I just thought I would just ask it. Is there a status on the habitat conservation plan for Lopez, or is that just something that we've been talking about for double-digit years and there's really no motivation to get it done?
Well, Mayor and Council, I'll try to answer that best I can. We've been through one complete iteration with one set of consultants for the Habitat Conservation Plan, and that iteration did not function correctly when examined in some detail. So the county has gone through a selection process, gotten new consultants, and the new consultants are actually making quite rapid progress, comparatively speaking, on the Habitat Conservation Plan. The last information that I received was that they had developed a downstream release model and were internally presenting that model and examining it to see if it would be functional and do what we need to do as far as releasing water downstream and preserving water in the lake, and getting ready to consider going over that downstream release model with the resource agencies such as Fish and Wildlife and Department of Fish and Game to see if they agreed that it was a good downstream release program. So we've made a lot of progress. We're not done, and we're way, way, way over any budget that anybody thought would be.
Yeah, I was going to spare you that question. So let me just turn to the city staff really quickly. Greg, you talked about stage four drought. I know that the council has declared a stage three. Stage four makes those conservation measures permanent. But given the performance that we've seen from this community, which this community has done a fantastic job, and we're really talking about conservation of, 28-30%, and we've exceeded state mandates. So outside of making those measures permanent, do we really expect going to stage four is going to help us conserve even more? Or maybe just some clarification around that.
I think so. You know, as the stage three requirement was a 10% reduction, it was relative to a comparative period, which was roughly spanned July 2013 mm-hmm. through June 2014. Over that period of time, the actual water amounts conserved ramped up pretty rapidly to 36% in one billing period. We're just under 30% right now. So averaging pretty much three times what we thought.
Yeah.
As a result of this, I think the most important outcome of this has been we've been able to reduce groundwater pumping. City of Grover Beach is probably, of the cities around us, probably the most reliant on groundwater resources. Yeah. You saw the allocations. We have really the lion's share of the groundwater allocation. And so it's critically important that the City of Grover Beach be able to reduce, to the extent possible, our reliance on groundwater. And we've been very successful with the Stage 3 mandate.
Yeah.
If you look at the urban, the water shortage contingency plan within the urban water management plan, and you followed the methodology for declaration of Stage 4, we're there. We could declare the Stage 4. Stage 4 anticipates a 25% conservation mandate, and so we're hitting 30s on average. I'd say we've achieved the goal, and I think at this point your staff's recommendation is that we basically keep the Stage 4 declaration in our pocket for early next year, again seeing what the effects of El Nino are and whether or not the lake in particular mm-hmm. Shows enough recharge in the lake levels that maybe we have we can anticipate a few more years of water supply there, and also seeing how the groundwater supply reacts to the winter. And if we see some rebound, even if it's even a partial rebound in the groundwater supply, we may be able to stave off that declaration. But I do think there's a point in time where either under emergency conditions or fairly certain prediction of continued decline, we will need to consider Stage 4.
Okay. And then I want to pivot to state water, because I want to just get some clarification. I know several years ago when Mr. Chisholm was in Mr. Fine's position, and there was and then it was also a different administration in Aurora Grandy. You know, we had convened meetings between the three mayors and the three city managers and public works directors, and we had looked at that possibility of becoming an enrollee state water. And it at that time appeared to be a negotiation between those who chose not to be and those who were. And more specifically, a negotiation between the city of Pismo Beach and the cities of Arroyo, Grande and Grover Beach. And so it got to be the cost of buying in, because it wasn't as simple as saying, hey, we now want to be an enrollee. The discussion that had come up was over the years that those folks who opted in had paid money for the actual construction of the line. So there had need to be some recuperation or reimbursement over those funds. So have times changed? I'm just wondering, is that environment different now?
I think, and I'll look to Jim Gehring to correct me if I wander off track here. But as Mr. Gehring was discussing state water, we're really talking about several options. The county itself has access to additional state water that could be delivered. It could be delivered, and it could be stored in Lopez Lake, or it could be delivered and delivered directly to in my belief, participating and non-participating agencies. The county is a state water purveyor.
Yeah.
So I believe that under certain circumstances, they could directly supply state water to the city of Grover Beach, or we could exchange state water for Lopez Lake water,
okay.
which is what we've done. Actually, Gehring alluded to it in his discussion. So there's the emergency supply situation. There's also the potential to use pipeline capacity to deliver state water on a continual basis. And in that scenario, it's likely that the city would need to become a state water project participant. Now, that would not necessarily involve a negotiation between cities, but it would likely involve a negotiation between the county and the state water project itself, you know, the state of California, in determining what would be the appropriate fair share costs of initial capital costs for the system. And it is likely that the other agencies would see some reduction in their overall costs as a result of that, because they've essentially paid their portion, their fair share portion of the water that's being delivered to the county. If a larger portion would be being delivered, there may be some benefit to them. But initially, I believe we would be negotiating directly with the county.
With the county.
With the state.
Okay. But thank you for that clarification. I wanted to make sure everyone didn't think it was a simple thing to do, because it's not. My last question, and City Manager, you can jump in here, regarding the water rate study, and I know the council has authorized this, but yeah, one of the things that came up and one of the reasons that I supported it at this time was the recent ruling on tiered water rates, and I believe that was with the City of San Juan Capistrano. So is that going to be looked at with this study?
Whatever the rates that are currently in effect will be reviewed as it relates to Proposition 218. And that ruling, and whatever rates or rate structure is recommended will also have to comply with that state law.
Yeah, because I think that has the potential to have the biggest impact, whether the council chooses to adjust rates or not, because that affects our existing rate structure today, potentially. Okay. Thanks, staff, and Mr. Gehring. I think this was a lot of good information, and well, we've been going at this for over an hour. I know this is probably something we should have just started this afternoon. staff, are you looking for any direction from the council?
Not at this point.
Okay.
This is a receive and file report, unless there is some specific direction the council wants to.
So let me do this. There are folks in the audience who've been here patiently. I want to say, does anyone want to address this item or any comments on this particular item?
Thank you, Mayor. Brad Snook, co-chair of our county's chapter of the Surf Rider Foundation. I'm going to stay around for the other items on the agenda as well. Some points that kind of came to mind during Mr. Gehring's excellent report was, you know, he was ahead of the times with the retention basins here, helping the city to slow down the urban runoff in those basins and then percolate that into the groundwater basin for recharge purposes. What that does is that allows the city to throw away less water. And so, you know, in December 2010, that was the big sewage spill down in Oceano, the South San Luis Obispo, you know, sanitation district sewage spill. And that's when Surf Rider really geared up, you know, coming to the council meetings and started talking to the councils about the cycle of insanity, about water recycling. That was 5 years ago. Those were 5 years that we really could have used to help this city and everybody else in this part of the regional water solution to throw away less water, because that's really the key. I mean, Mr. Gehring never got to mention the word sustainability during his presentation. When can we, you know, throw away less so that we can have a report that actually says this is the year that we expect to be, you know, at least at a sustainable level so that we can build supply so that we can create a buffer? Those are the discussions that we want to have, and the only way we can do that is by throwing less water away. We need more support from the county and from the state, because what you just heard in this report is a microcosm of what's happening statewide. The surface waters have been drained dry and the habitats are suffering. And so we're seeing the same problem coming out of Lopez. Our surface waters are suffering because we suck those dry. After that, we suck the groundwater dry. After that, what do? We start talking about desalination because it looks like an easy supply, but that's very energy intensive. The state water project is also very energy intensive. And the state is dealing with the same supply issues that we are on a local level. So I urge the council not to look for the state for solutions. Ask the state for support. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Snook.
Good evening. My name is Mary Lucy from Oceano. I have to applaud you for having the water forum. Too bad we're in a state of emergency after 5 years and we couldn't have tried to prevent it a little bit. But I think that as a little tiny strip of highway next door, we did the best we could to sustain ourselves, and sustainability kind of has been a model, you know, not sidewalks, but sustainability or potholes. And so I was hoping to hear that you would have thought about a marketing campaign for conservation, but it's hard to conserve something you don't have, you know. And when you start getting really low into how many gallons per person per day, and if I read the numbers correctly, next year you're going to be down to 43.5% gallons per person per day. And I think, and of course you'll have to ask one of the engineers or one of the experts, that you need a minimum of 50 to 55 gallons per person in each household. So there's another catch to the to this. It's not just one, but if your water levels drop so much. Now, Oceano, we do have over 500 acre feet in storage now. And we did lose that charge because we looked at it as sustainability for all, not just for Oceano. You know, we did, we never relied on others to bring our drinking water in, because I just think we're not very trusting by nature and we just overbought. You know, but the point being is that we're very thankful now that we overbought. Now, our state water bill would suck up your reserve in one payment. That's how expensive it is. And it's not just that you can go to the county and they can rename their state allocations and sell it to you. It doesn't work like that. State water purveyors get first right of refusal always. And so I know Pismo has some very expensive water sources. We have some very expensive water sources, but we don't have any sidewalks, but we have water. So there are other things you can do besides just the conservation, but I would start with a social marketing program. What I'm going to do today is I'm going to plead with you to look at the South County Sanitation District as your savior, as a lifeline to this city. I have many, many friends. I mean, we haven't always got along, you know, great, but hey, you know what? We're all in this together, whether we like it or not. We're all sucking off the same basin. We're all drinking off the same dam, you know, and we're all flushing our toilets and our sinks. And it's going to the sanitation district, and then it's going out into the ocean. And the main problem is that the politics has gotten so heavy at the sanitation district. I'm going to all of us and begging that we put our best foot forward. We got 3 million to 5 million gallons a day going out. How many Grover residents could use that? And we already have that resource. So we could all just kind of step back, you know, take a deep breath, realize that those are our resources that are, you know, it might not look too pretty and smell very pretty, but, you know, hey, you know, it's that lemonade thing, you know, and we could take that water source and quite possibly, you know, really, really help Grover, but at the current time, I don't foresee it happening before I die or anything like that. So, thank you.
Thank you, Mary. Is there anyone else?
Ben Fine, Director of Public Works, City Engineer, City of Pismo Beach. Just want to let you know I am here if you guys have any questions. And then also, Mr. Ray had mentioned during his presentation that none of the agencies have gone to a moratorium route, and I just want to let you guys know that tomorrow night our council will be considering possible building restrictions with a three-tiered system that they'll consider.
Great. Thank you, Ben. Okay, seeing no one else come forward. And everyone who spoke, please fill out a blue form, blue slip before you leave tonight. Thank you.
Yeah. How you doing? My name is Jason Allen. I am a father of a family here in town that has worked from the time that we bought our house in late 2012 all the way to present to be very conservative in our water usage. Since the 2013 time when our water is being measured, our family has over doubled. And there has been no allocation for the increased household members. There has also been no allocation for our family being highly water conservative from the start of that process coming in to the time that you guys are measuring off of. During our time, we've been penalized twice now for our water penalty. We petitioned the first time. Due to our family doubling and my wife's medical condition that requires water as a source of relief, running water as a source of relief. And we haven't received a response back to the beginning, the early October submission that we presented in to that. Your guys' site says that it takes about 10 days to process that. After day 12, we called and we asked for information on that. Information we were told by your water conservation specialist that he was waiting till our next bill was put in or was received, or our next water usage was received before he was going to make any definition or finality on our waiver, which and we still haven't received anything back from that. I spoke to your city manager regarding this. He told me he was going to write a letter of response to me. I haven't received that response back. And as a citizen, we're actually looking at seriously moving out of the community now because we can't afford to continually incur these penalties because our family situation has doubled. It not taking this issue seriously when you guys are taking the issue seriously in this situation, but when you take it seriously from the fairness of the citizens, it encourages us to leave, and it encourages families to leave the area. It's not well thought out, and it's not well communicated back to us. When we call and speak to a conservation specialist, the first two conversations, he said it was based on 2014 numbers. When I questioned him on that, he told me it was based on actually 2013 numbers, but he doesn't go into the details of that. Numerous times he gave me conflicting information that I had to question time and time and time again. So when your specialist doesn't quite understand the process and the goals of your guys' situation, it honestly comes across as more of a financial situation for you guys rather than a conservation situation. And I think that it needs to be something that is taken really seriously and reviewed to make it equitable for people that are increasing their household size in your community. Thank you,
Mr. Allen. And I did notice that you had filled out a speaker request form for the next item, so we'll be discussing that in a lot more detail.
No, I'll say, but I was just told the wrong time. Sorry.
No, that's okay. So when we discuss the other item, I'll give you another opportunity to come up and speak again. Sound good?
Yeah.
Okay. Seeing no one else come forward, let me bring it back to the council. And at this point, I think staff is saying you're not looking for any specific direction tonight.
That's correct.
And I did, one thing I did not bring up earlier was I think you had talked about possibly an update to our 2010 urban water management plan.
Yeah, we'll also, that's an item that the council may want to deal with along with the first quarter report.
Okay.
We'll be taking a look at goals and tasks, and that would be an appropriate time to address that.
Very good. Thank you, everyone, for all the good information, detailed information, and the comments. We appreciate that. So at this point, we're going to take a 10-minute break. special meeting for the Grover Beach City Council. And I believe when we concluded, we had just ended on item number one. And we are now going to move to item number two, I believe. And that is discussion regarding participation in a regional project for recycled. I'm sorry. And that's going to be modifications to the water shortage contingency plan and the water conservation incentive programs. Mr. Ray, you have the floor.
Thank you, Honorable Mayor and City Council. The Water Shortage Contingency Plan is a plan that identifies actions and regulations that can be enacted by council in response to any water shortage condition. We touched on that briefly relative to the Stage 3 water shortage and the possibility of a Stage 4 water shortage condition. The current plan was adopted by council as part of the 2010 Urban Water Management Plan, which is a requirement of the state. Also, I believe earlier there was a brief discussion about the Urban Water Management Plan, and an update is due to the state in June of next year, I believe. June or July of next year, we'll be submitting a draft. But in particular, the Water Shortage Contingency Plan includes water use prohibitions and mandatory conservation targets. In 2014, the council adopted the Stage 3 water shortage condition. This does include the requirement to reduce water consumption by 10% compared to previous use. As mentioned earlier, the base period for comparison spans from July of 2013 through June of 2014. There are water use prohibitions, which include a requirement for automatic shutoff nozzles on hoses, prohibits washdown of driveways and streets when other methods are available. Prohibits irrigation waste, including excessive runoff, and prohibits the use of potable water for construction. When a water customer fails to meet the mandatory 10% reduction requirement, the city provides multiple opportunities to comply. The first two-month billing period, failure to comply results in a courtesy letter. In the second two-month billing period, we send a warning letter. During the third two-month billing period, failure to comply results in a penalty in the amount of 100% of the customer's consumption charge. And then each of the following two-month billing periods, the penalty is increased by 100% up to a total of 300% of the water consumption charge. As you can see, it's a 2-, 4-, 6-month period results in the first penalty, and then periods of 2 months beyond that up to 300%.
Actually, just a quick clarification. Is that not, since there are 2 month billing cycles, wouldn't it be 10 months?
I didn't cover them all. 2, 4, 6, oh, 8, 10.
Gotcha.
You're right.
So it is 10 months, 5 billing
right.
cycles. Okay. Gotcha.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The program has been very successful. On average, as I mentioned earlier, the city has achieved about 30% savings per billing period, which is really exceptional. In the last 6 months, the city residents have done a great job of reducing water use. And during that period, we've only had 3.4% of customers receive a first penalty. It's a very small number. Only 1.3% of our water customers have received a second penalty, and only 0.7% have received a third penalty. The city provides outreach and education to help people with their compliance efforts. And the city offers inspections for businesses to assist with compliance. The Stage 3 declaration was intended to achieve a 10% reduction in water consumption. As we mentioned earlier, we've achieved far greater. But it's important to note that water supplies are at all-time lows, and rainfall so far has eluded us. A Stage 4 condition is currently warranted. And as I mentioned earlier, Stage 4 condition would be a 25% mandatory reduction, and we would have to reconsider the base period for that. Again, staff is not currently recommending moving to a Stage 4, but under certain conditions, staff would recommend resurrecting that discussion, and that would include either a short-term emergency reduction in water supplies or a continuing trend and a continuing decline in the water levels available to the city. The penalty program, I believe, has been working about as well as can be expected. Of course, we can't expect everyone to be happy with the program. We have received a handful of complaints. You heard one tonight. And we've received a significant number of waiver requests. Since adoption of the program, We've approved about 80 waiver requests, which is about 25% of all penalties been waived. We approve waivers in cases where there's a significant increase in household occupancy or another verifiable reason for unusual water use. As you can imagine, these are difficult because they're all one-of-a-kind cases, involve a lot of discussion and in some cases, verification. We do require that persons requesting a waiver demonstrate efforts to conserve water to the maximum extent practicable. We think that's really important in keeping with the purpose of the program. And in some cases, we have established a modified baseline consumption amount. This is especially used for when a resident has just moved into a house. There's no base period to compare them against, or in cases of apartment buildings where the residency in the apartment buildings is changing regularly. For businesses to receive a waiver, we require that businesses develop what we call a water conservation plan. And that's essentially a plan that includes fixture retrofits and other measures and includes a timeline for execution of those measures. As long as the business complies with that plan that they develop, they will receive and continue to receive a waiver. But if they are not in compliance, then the waiver would not be granted. There are some modifications to the program, you know, just based on staff's experience to date and reviewing plans from other cities. We've come up with some ideas that council may want to consider. Council could consider providing mandatory conservation training for customers requesting a waiver. I know that the city of Arroyo Grande currently does that, and they're just now embarking on their first phase of actual penalties. Council could consider identifying a fixed penalty amount instead of an amount based on 100% of water consumption and tiered from there. Council could consider modifying the penalty provisions to exempt businesses. Several of our adjacent agencies do exempt businesses from the program. But based on the success of the current program, staff is not recommending any of these changes. I want to move from the water conservation mandatory requirements and penalty program to the city's incentive program, which is helping residents and businesses to comply with our water conservation mandates. The city offers a handful of conservation incentives in form of retrofit and rebate programs. They include the plumbing fixture retrofit program, which is primarily the toilet retrofit program, a washing machine rebate program, the cash for grass program, and the smart irrigation controller rebate program. The chart behind me indicates participation levels in each of the programs, both in fiscal year 15 and 16. In the 2015 fiscal year, 290 toilets were retrofit. 44 people received cash for removal of areas of turf. 37 people received rebates for high-efficiency washing machines. And there was only one rebate received for a smart irrigation controller. Since July of 2016, the beginning of this fiscal year, 64 toilets have been retrofit. 38 people have received cash for removal of turf. 6 people have received rebates for high-efficiency washing machines. And again, one more smart irrigation controller rebate. Based on experience implementing the program, staff is recommending modifications to two of the programs. They include the plumbing fixture retrofit program, and the cash for grass program. Currently, the plumbing retrofit program requires the city to purchase toilets, and we store them at the corporate yard. They're basically one type of toilet and one color, meeting the 1.28 gallon per flush requirement. We pay the plumber $100 for installation of these toilets, and participants in the program must use a city-approved plumber. In staff's opinion, this has slowed participation in the program, and we have developed a considerable backlog of requests. Staff is recommending the following changes. Allow for private purchase of toilets, as long as they comply with the 1.28 gallon per flush requirement and continue with, again, the $100 rebate, and allow participants to choose a plumber of their own choice and continue with the $100 rebate for those plumbers' installation costs. And we would also like to allow enrollment by commercial properties, but require that commercial properties who enroll install waterless urinals when feasible. Staff also recommends prioritizing applications. We know that the funds have been limited, and so staff is recommending prioritizing in the following order. First priority would be single or multifamily properties with existing 3.5 gallon or greater use per flush toilets. Second priority would be commercial urinals, because going to a waterless urinal has a significant impact on water use. Third, we would recommend apartments with existing toilets of 3.5 gallons per flush or more. And then all other applicants would be prioritized with available remaining available funds. Staff is also recommending that the cash for grass program be modified. And this is primarily to clarify landscape coverage and definition requirements. We found through implementation of the program that it's not a typical application where a person comes in with a development application and says, hey, I want to develop a property of this size. And staff has the opportunity then to say, oh, by the way, there's landscape coverage requirements. There's only so much of the property can be covered by a house, only so much of the property can be covered by a driveway. They simply read the contents of the program online and expect, basically, if I tear my turf out, I should be getting money for it. And so we want to clarify a few things. First of all, staff recommends we add language to the program to indicate that landscape must comply with the development code. That includes coverage, definitions, everything. We're recommending that 40% of the turf removal area be covered by drought-tolerant plants. So as clarity, that amounts to about a 2-foot-wide plant planted every 4 feet on center. And that's kind of typical with what we're seeing now with these drought-tolerant landscapes. They're more loosely planted. You have small 1 to 2 foot plants planted about 2 to 3 feet on center. And we want to clarify that we expect at least that level of planting. It's not, especially in front yards, we don't really want to see solid rock in the front yards or all hardscape.
Yes. I'm sorry. 40% coverage. Are you talking about 40% that they would take out that would be subject to the program, not their entire yard?
That's correct. So if okay. I removed 100 square feet of turf and enrolled as a participant in the program, we'd expect basically 40 square feet to actually be plant material, not just be rock, gravel, something else.
Oh, interesting.
And that amounts to, again, about what you're seeing now is this loose planting environment.
Okay. Because I'm thinking if someone puts in porous pavers, that kind of be something we would want to encourage. So I'm just curious.
I would agree. And okay. So the program does allow for, porous pavers or other materials to be placed currently. And it encourages, in fact, that's considered landscape. However, there is a maximum coverage allowable, again, per the development code. So while we would encourage mulch, gravel, rock, porous pavers, paving stones, other things to be included with the landscape, and would allow development of patios in that area, we also do want to see, though, a planting component associated with that. And then finally, staff is recommending that we add language indicating that the retention requirements would apply to any new impervious materials. So, example, you mentioned pervious pavers, but if a person wanted to construct a patio as a result of this program and they were impervious pavers or solid concrete or asphalt, the retention requirements included in the development code would apply to that.
Okay.
The city has already paid a significant amount to participants in the program, the various incentive programs, in an effort to assist customers with compliance. In fiscal year 15, the city paid out almost $100,000 in incentives. And to date, since July, the city has paid out almost $60,000. Moving to staff's recommendation, staff is recommending the council adopt the resolution amending the plumbing retrofit fixture program and cash for grass programs as identified by staff. As an option, council could provide additional direction. And this concludes my report, and I'd be happy to answer any questions at this time.
Thank you, Greg. Let's see if Barbara, you have any questions?
Yes, I do. Why is decomposed granite considered impervious?
I'm glad you asked that question. So in your staff report, I didn't cover it tonight in the brief presentation, but in your staff report, it does indicate that compacted decomposed granite would be considered impervious. We know from experience that if well compacted, decomposed granite, while it will absorb water directly into the surface itself, essentially immediately acts as a barrier to further penetration of water. Mm-hmm. So we are seeing landscapes involving loose raked in decomposed granite, and we're allowing that as a mulch alternative. But beyond that, if a project were to completely cover and compact with decomposed granite, we would expect to see greater amounts of runoff, and we would be looking at that relative to the retention requirements.
So you would recommend using that in the same way that you would use a gravel or something like that, as opposed to using it for pathways?
Yeah, so what we're finding is that while the majority of people historically have used decomposed granite for pathways or patios, we're finding now, actually there's a couple of projects within the Cash for Grass program that have used it as mulch. It's basically, mm-hmm. other than the plant material, it's the only other material. Ah. It's a nice desert look, provides mm-hmm. a really nice look for cactuses and succulents, but if compacted well enough, it does increase runoff significantly.
Okay, thank you.
Mayor Pro-Tem Lee.
Thank you. I did have a couple questions. So, and I'll start kind of backwards, but thank you for that presentation, Greg. So if we start on the last slide, the second to last slide, with regards to the fiscal impacts, where in last year's program there was about $100,000 paid out, this year about $57,000. And yet if you go to the participation levels, it looks like we have fewer people participating but at higher levels. Is there an explanation for that, or is that just more people taking out larger areas of turf, or how does that relate?
I think you're seeing greater participation in the Cash for Grass program as opposed to what was more toilet retrofits originally.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Yeah, because it looks like we've had slightly less than six fewer people doing Cash for Grass in a six-month period than we did all of last year.
Right. Okay.
So next question is, with regards to the rebate programs, is there a, I guess it would be called a sunset or a time limit from the time that that the person purchases the fixture to the longest time they could go before they waited to request the rebate? Case in point, and I'll throw myself under the bus here, is my family bought a new washer and dryer about 18 months ago. Is there a length of time beyond which that rebate would no longer be applicable?
I think what we're looking for is enrollment in the program, okay. Initial enrollment. So I don't think you'd be eligible for the program. Let's say, for example, if you decided to tear out your back lawn randomly.
Right.
I'm just going to tear out my back lawn. And then you maybe bought some plants and landscaped it and then came in a month later and said, hey, I hear you guys have a Cash for Grass program. You probably wouldn't be eligible. We want to have the opportunity to see what was there, to actually acknowledge that there was an irrigation system associated with the turf, and then be able to verify that the amount of turf was removed and the appropriate materials went back in.
Okay.
And same would apply to toilet retrofits and to washing machine rebates, as an example.
Okay, great. So staying on the fixture thought for a second, with regards to the optional modifications, can you give a maybe just a little background as to what new construction is required to do with regards to retrofitting, and I guess that wouldn't be retrofitting, but installing new fixtures that are water saving? Does the city have the applicable codes to where it requires, or does the building code have the applicable line items where you can't put in a 3.5 gallon toilet anymore? You have to put in a 1.2 or a 1.8.
Yes. So by default, by adopting the California Building Code, which also includes the Green Building Code as part of it, and has under Title 22, I believe, requirements for certain plumbing fixtures. new plumbing fixtures are extremely restrictive. That includes both sink, toilets, shower heads, outdoor fixtures. Everything has a certain amount of restriction on it, and they're fairly low levels. I noticed that a lot of the new homes that are being built that have families of four living in them, their water use is well below average water use in the city. So.
And that's basically a benefit of the new development because of compliance with existing with the new code and the green code.
It truly is.
Okay, great. So, and I'm sorry that Ms. Lucy left, but as part of the water shortage contingency plan, I was kind of thinking that would be a possibility of where her marketing or education comment from our prior item might have fit in. But I see that you're not making any recommendations to change our educational program or so forth. Is there something that we might be able to do that could piggyback on Arroyo Grande's educational program, whether it be even just a reference to it or something that kind of a regional collegiality partnership to that? Or is that, I don't want to use their good work and kind of without paying for it, so to speak, or without having them get a benefit. But is there a regional effort that we can do from an educational, or is that already being done?
So the city of Arroyo Grande, with, I believe, participation from the city of Pismo Beach, had hired Verdin Marketing, and they actually have a formal marketing campaign for water conservation. Just by being their neighbors, we're benefiting from that program. The city itself, we utilize the city's website, Facebook pages, Twitter feeds, and our semi-annual newsletter to distribute information, as well as the penalty program itself. I mean, if you just barely miss the 10% conservation requirement, you get a courtesy letter that comes with an educational component, information about how to conserve, programs that are available, you know, what it means. So I think if you look at the success of our program, mm-hmm. And that we're spending in the neighborhood of $100,000 a year on the incentives, I don't see where more is necessarily warranted. We're doing very well at about 30% reduction right now.
Okay, right. And I think you bring up a very valid point there, which leads me to my last question, which has to do with something that, again, you alluded to it in the prior staff report, but under the page 2 of the staff report under discussion, where it's called Stage 3 Water Shortage Condition, there's a couple sentences in there, one of which reads, "This reduced water production result exceeds the anticipated outcome of the Stage 3 implementation." Or is that better said when you, in the first staff report, you said where our water conservation program has conserved 700 acre feet of water, where the Stage 4 we're doing that already, so we've effectively saved 700 acre feet of water with the Stage 3 program versus if we went to a different program or different incentives.
Well, I think what I'm saying is that, you know, the idea with the Stage 3 was to achieve 10% conservation,
right?
A 10% reduction in water use. And so I think if we had achieved only 10%, we actually might be considering a Stage 4, mm-hmm. Anticipating that maybe the Stage 4 would barely or only achieve 25%. But with the 10% mandatory reduction requirement, we've achieved 30%.
30%, right.
And so, you know, it's operating at a much more efficiently than we thought it would. And so, mm-hmm. as a result, it's hard to recommend going to a 25% reduction, which may in fact result in, I don't know what the maximum amount could be at this point, but maybe as much as a 50% reduction in water use when it doesn't appear to be warranted as of yet.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Gotcha. Okay. And then my last question has to do with a very more analytical side of things. Is we've got residential customers, we've got commercial customers, we've got industrial customers, and we've got probably some agricultural customers. How do the Stage 3 water shortage conditions impact each one of those? I mean, we probably, the focus from a community standpoint, obviously, is probably on the residences. But is that sector doing better than, say, the commercial sector or the industrial sector with regards to conservation? And so should we be looking at residential, you're doing great, stay the course, and we should be looking at commercial, or commercial's doing great, let's take them off the list. We should focus on industrial, kind of that thought. Has that been discussed?
Yeah, in terms of very detailed data relating to the various water uses you identified, well, first of all, we have no agricultural uses, believe it or not. They're all on private wells.
Okay.
There's estimates within the urban water, or I'm sorry, within the NCMA annual report as to what percentage of the total basin is being used by agricultural, commercial, industrial, and other uses. But jumping back sort of to the city's experience, within the conservation program, I think we're really seeing that residential customers, by and large, are complying with the program and doing quite well. I mean, there are a few outstanding individuals that aren't doing well, but by and large, it's 97 or 8% compliance. We're seeing that business owners are having more difficulty, and surprisingly, a lot of it appears to have to do with education and understanding. And most of those people are getting that education very directly as a result of the first warning notice. We generally get a call. We're conducting site visits. We're conducting on-site education. We're providing materials related specifically to their business. Most recently, a dog grooming business. We had visited one dog grooming business and found that actually some of the water uses they had could be more conservative. There are better fixtures available. There were different ways of doing things. And then as late as last week, we had another dog grooming place call and say, you know, I don't see how I could possibly conserve more. And in comparing the size of the two businesses and their water use, we found that the second business called was using quite a bit more water than the first business. And so, again, we're going to do a site visit. We will identify that information. So I think we're finding that the business customers are having more difficulty in complying. There are a lot of different kinds of fixtures. It's not just as simple as taking out some grass and retrofitting a toilet or taking a shorter shower. You're talking about washing dishes. You're talking about preparing soup, you know, things that require water. So we're trying to be very fair in the application and implementation of this program. I've been working with, you know, both myself, our water conservation specialist, and in many cases with the city manager to reach out to businesses and to help them comply. And I think they're a much smaller component of the overall water use. Residential use comprises over 80% of our water use, but we're still seeing, by and large, commercial entities and businesses having more difficulty.
Okay. Councilmember Wright, Jimmy. Are you done? Okay. You have any questions?
Okay. Thank you. My questions are more related to the actual procedure of how you're able to benefit from these programs, particularly from my perspective, I feel like I don't have any grass and so on and so on. So I'm thinking, you know, for like the retrofits of like the shower heads and aerators and the toilets and so on. So then I had heard from some of our residents that when they had applied or enrolled for, let's say, the toilet retrofit program, there was quite a delay in actually getting the fixture replaced. So by modifying the requirements whereby you can purchase your own, you can contact your own plumber and so on, I would think that would alleviate that problem quite a bit. Would you agree?
That was the intent.
Okay, very good. Okay, thank you. So then what about shower fixtures and aerators? Do they have to be installed by a licensed plumber as well?
As the program currently stands, yes.
Okay. That
basically, without modification, you would contact us for the plumbing fixture retrofit program. We would retrofit the toilet as well as go through faucet and shower aerators and modify those to comply with current requirements for maximum flow rates.
It's a package deal then, basically. If you retrofit the toilet, the shower heads and everything else goes along with it.
That's how it's worked so far.
Okay.
And, you know, we've had varying degrees of participation. Some people have declined the other components. They don't want the saving aerators and shower heads. They like it the way it is now. And, you know, if they can meet the required 10% reduction requirements without it, so be it. They may be just taking shorter showers or
right.
washing their hands for less time. But I think we would continue, if a person wanted to only do aerators and other fixtures, we would certainly allow for that.
Okay, because I'm thinking some folks may have already purchased that low-flow toilet, but they haven't gone the whole gamut, right. particularly folks who think that they've pretty much gone, like Mr. Allen, gone as low as you can go. Where do I go from here? And then maybe you have to look to those things. Okay, very good.
And just a follow-up to that, if I might, you know, by and large, those fixtures, the aerators and the reducers for shower heads, in most cases, they're available nearly free, if not free. There's programs every year through the county, through the state, that hand out boxes and boxes of things. You can find them at events, and then you can install them yourself.
Great. Okay, very good. Then Miss Lucy had mentioned something about how many gallons per day was required for residential use per person. Do you happen to know what that number is?
I do. So with the approximately 30% conservation that we have achieved, I should say the residents have achieved, to be fair, we're down to about 75 gallons per capita per day. I think the number is actually 73 or 4, but, okay. but approximately 75 gallons per person per day.
And
so the state, in looking at, you know, what's the minimal amount of water that we should expect to supply for, you know, sanitary, drinking, food preparation purchases, the state's thrown out a number of 50 gallons per person per day. So if, you know, the drought continued, for example, the state mm-hmm. might consider mandating, you know, you get 50 gallons per person per day. And there you go. That's all that we're going to allow you to use until
right.
the drought's over. In the text of your report, which I did not go into detail in my presentation, it talks about potential loss of one of our water supplies.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at today, you know, by trying to reduce our reliance on groundwater, we're about using surface water and groundwater equally. So if you lost one, it would be about half our water supply. If you lost either one, the lake goes dry, saltwater intrusion. Under that scenario, without emergency water supply immediately available, we would be reduced to down around 40-something gallons per capita per day. And so you could see that that's, considering current use, that would be a pretty significant reduction.
Absolutely. So then per capita water usage, does that include landscaping as well?
Currently includes all uses.
Okay, all uses per person.
That includes, so that's all city water use. That's by businesses, landscaping, construction purposes, street sweeping, you know, household uses, every use you can imagine, divided by the population,
okay.
results in about 75 gallons per
Great.
Capita per day.
Very good. I think those are my only questions. I have a comment or two, but
okay.
I'll do that later. Thank
Very
you.
Good.
Thank you.
Councilmember Shaw.
Thank you for the report. It was really informative, and I'm so glad Councilmember Bright asked about the toilets, because I too have always approached about the wait list, and I commend you guys for coming up with that as hopefully a solution. One thing I want to ask about is the cash for grass proposed changes, and I'm reading through Exhibit B, which kind of lays out. I find it very confusing still. Maybe it's just the way it's worded, or maybe I'm just not understanding, but especially as I look at in the bullet points of Exhibit B, the bullet points 4 and 5, and 6. Because 5 says, okay, so first 4 says you have to comply with the city development codes. Then 5 says at least 40% of the turf area replaced in the front yard must be covered by plants. Then it says
plant materials.
So then it says turf must be replaced with landscaping. So can 40% of that now be what's defined as landscaping, or are you saying the remaining 60% needs to be landscaping?
That's a great question. So you can understand that many people have found confusion with this, and this is an effort to try and reduce the confusion only by perhaps adding some more requirements. But in particular, if you look at the city's development code, it defines landscape to include plants and hardscape. So you know, like a typical landscape plan, I could say I'm going to landscape my front yard, and that could include a patio, some walkways, maybe decorative pavers, a couple trees, some turf, some plants, some mulch, right? It's a combination of things. So landscaping, as defined in the city development code, is a fairly broad term. As it relates to the cash for grass program, we're saying, okay, continue to follow that definition, and also note that the city's development code says that no more than 40%, and pardon the duplicative numbers because we're using 40% again relative to plant material, but the development code says in particular that in your front yard no more than 40% can be covered by hardscape. So even though landscaping includes hardscape in the development code, it basically has a restriction that says, but we don't want to see your entire front yard hardscaped. We want to see some plants, you know, some trees and plants. That's the look that is intended by the regulations within the development code. And I'm wandering way into the community development director's area here, but he'll stop me, I'm sure, if I get off course too far. So then we consider, hey, we have the cash for grass program. Well, first of all, it needs to be internally consistent, so it needs to comply with the development code. But we were receiving a lot of applications for the cash for grass rebate that basically said, I'm going to remove the turf and put in rocks. Only rocks. And in some of these front yards, there was only turf. So the result would be a completely rock or gravel front yard. And I think in looking at this, the original intent of the cash for grass program was that turf would be removed and replaced with turf alternatives. So there are grass-like alternatives out there, buffalo grass, things like that, and other drought-tolerant species. Therein lies the problem. If you follow the cash for grass program as originally intended, then you can't put in a bunch of rock or a bunch of mulch or hardscape or other materials as part of participation in this program. You have to go back with all plants, pretty much full coverage. So this modification says, okay, first of all, we acknowledge that the development code allows other materials as landscape. So you can have mulch or gravel or pavers, you can develop a patio, you can do walkways, but you can't hardscape, as part of that landscape, you can't hardscape more than 40% of your front yard, still in compliance with the development code. And of the area that you replace, we want to see at least 40% coverage with plants. That's very loose coverage with plant material. That looks about like what you're seeing the typical drought-tolerant landscape today. You either see rock and gravel or mulch and a plant every few feet. So we're trying to get the program to match current state-of-the-art but still be internally consistent with the development code.
Okay. I think I'm understanding what you're saying, and I understand your intent of trying to comply with our development code of only 40% being hardscape, and I know the effort is to simplify it, but this seems to make it more confusing because, I don't know, couldn't you just say, your end result of your yard product, 40, remember, only 40% can be hardscape. Because let's say, for example, I planned to do cash for grass, but I only planned to do it in 20% of my yard. And then 40% of that 20% needs to be, can, the maximum 40% of that 20% can be hardscape, but what if the rest of my yard I left grass? So really the rest of my yard was already compliant.
Good question. So let's say in your scenario, to help understand this, that you replace 20% of your existing turf as a result of this program. Within that area, 40% of it needs to now be planted with drought-tolerant plants instead of turf. The remainder can be anything you want. In your case, if your lot, let's say had no driveway, and the rest of your lot was grass, okay, then you're already compliant with the requirement for landscape coverage per the development code. You're clearly not exceeding the 40% maximum coverage of hardscape area per the development code. And you could add, in the area that you replaced, you could add a patio for 60% of it and plants for 40% of it.
Okay. Well, I heard we're going to comment later, so I'll comment later. The other thing I just wanted to bring up, because I know we're really only talking about, in terms of changes, the retrofitting and the cash for grass, but it was also the penalties were mentioned in the report, and I know we had a meeting back in June to discuss specifically the water conservation and the penalties and how they were functioning. And we talked about some similar issues like Mr. Allen is having with families that were already conserving to the maximum and then possibly increased family members or had special situations. I know back in June we talked about, what about breaks for senior citizens that may not be able to do construction? Do we have at this point, some sort of, because I understand it's a very small percentage of people who are being penalized, but do we have a formal system for this now so that people like Mr. Allen can rely on what's going on? Or is it a case-by-case basis? Is it written out?
It is a case-by-case basis. There is a waiver request form that you can fill out. The waiver request form itself provides some guidance. It identifies, the kinds of information we need. It does indicate that we'd like some way of verifying, if you say, boy, I had 2 adults last year and now I have 8. Well, if you can provide some way of verifying that, we're looking for that to help us, clearly understand what your water consumption might be. And then once we have that information in hand, we use a fairly, we've been trying to equitably and fairly apply our consideration of a waiver across the board. In certain cases, we do hear oftentimes, somebody comes in and says, I have a family of 4, we're using 50 units of water, and we couldn't possibly conserve more. And I would point to several people in this council chambers tonight that have families of 4 or greater that are using around 17 units of water per billing system. So we get that all the time. We have a lot of people come and say, I just can't possibly conserve more than 60. And the reality is that through education and through engagement through the water penalty waiver request process, both myself and the city's water conservation specialist, and in certain circumstances, even the city manager, have been able to identify numerous occasions where water is being wasted. We've found leaks by doing meter reads. So, yes, we have a very thorough program, but it is case by case. It's the nature of the program itself.
And do people have reliable timelines? Because people, they need to plan. If their next bill is coming, maybe they don't want to wait that long. When it's too late, maybe their penalty is not going to be waived. How long must a person wait to have a judgment on their waiver?
We have been slow. Depending on the workload and the number of waiver requests, we had at one point as many as 200 in process. So it was a slow process in getting them all out, and they did lapse over a billing period. We are attempting to have them out before the beginning of the next billing period.
Okay. And it was talked about in the report, possibly the penalty phase of going from 100% to 200% to 300%. Do you find that increasing the fines like that really dramatically helps to curb people's water use? Or do you think at 100% fine, people are pretty motivated? Do you think the 200 and 300 are more just adding salt to the wound? Or do people not pay attention till 200%?
Well, I look at the numbers, and that's really all I have to go on. If you go back and look at the numbers relative to penalties, 3.4%.
Greg, do me a favor.
Yes.
What's the number? Stop using these small percentages. I want to know actual numbers. So I'm trying to be very patient to get to everybody else's questions. But Can you give us numbers that are associated with that? And the other part of this is not so much just numbers, but who are the ones that are affected by this? Because we talked last time, there were shopping centers. There were other businesses that could be critically affected by this. So I want to be be completely transparent and open in this discussion. So as you go forward, those are some things to think of. Sorry about that.
Well, so and I'll double check my number here, but we have about 4,200 water customers, 4,800 water customers. Let's call it 5,000. And so if you look at 3.4%, that's about 150. In the neighborhood of 150 have received a first penalty.
Okay.
Over the last 6 months. In the neighborhood of 50 have received a second penalty. And less than 1%, less than 5% have received a third penalty.
Okay.
So looking at the numbers, it's not necessarily a valid conclusion, but one could conclude that the escalating penalties are very effective because the numbers go from 150 to 50 to 4.
Mm-hmm. Well, that is really helpful to have the numbers because when you look at the percentages, it doesn't seem like it makes much of a difference.
Right. But the other factor you have to consider is that with first penalty comes a significant educational effort by the city. So that could also have a dramatic impact. The mayor asked a specific question relative to who does this impact? Well, by and large, it impacts residents. By and large. Okay. We do have some business water customers who have failed to meet the requirement. Very few of them have been penalized because most have elected to enroll in what we're calling the water conservation plan. And most have been successful in doing that. As an example, the grocery store that you mentioned, a very effective and thorough water conservation plan, and we've done follow-up inspections and revisits to be sure that they're staying in compliance with that. So we're finding that businesses are having the hardest time complying, but they represent a very small number of non-compliance issues, and by and large, they're being granted penalties because they're engaging themselves in a process of installing fixtures and modifying their practices.
Thank you. That's all I have.
And how many of those 5,000 customers are businesses?
Roughly 20%. So
10% would be 50. We can play this number game. We can play this numbers game all night.
200.
Okay. So I get it. Looking at the percentages, it's been largely.
I'm sorry, 1,000.
Okay.
My brain.
It's my turn now. Yeah. Everyone else has had a chance. So. I can see by the small percentages, yes, if we want to go down that road, it's been a successful program. But have you asked those folks that have gotten to the first penalty stage and then fixed everything up through education so they didn't move to the second penalty, was the threat of a penalty more important than education? Because I think to get to Marion's question, it's really, are people doing this because they're trying to be conscientious, and then when they have the education, they're doing the right thing as opposed to the threat of doubling their rates. Do we have we surveyed that? Do we know that?
No.
Okay.
Okay. Can I ask a side question towards that?
Okay, one question.
Sure. How much water are we talking about? I mean, you went towards the number of customers, which I think is a very mm-hmm. valid question. How much water are we talking about with regards to this conservation? Like, if we were to add up all of the water that has been spent, for lack of a better term, for penalized for, how many do we have an idea?
I don't.
Because I think that goes towards your question of how effective is this program for the amount of staff time that we're putting into it.
And that is an add-on to it. You're right. That's a natural companion to that question.
Okay. I mean, anyway. we know that conservation in general has amounted to about a 700-acre-foot savings, which is almost equal to your entire Lopez water entitlement. How much... Well, it's impossible to say, you know, how much might have been saved if everybody complied. These are really small numbers, so probably not much more if these people would have all complied.
So then I do want to ask regarding the process for those who have been not denied waivers. Are they made aware of all of their administrative remedies, meaning is the system set up to where staff is the end-all, be-all, or can those decisions be appealed to council if need be?
Absolutely. The process is very clear. Okay. It begins with the water conservation specialist, promotes to myself if necessary, promotes to the city manager if necessary, and then ultimately they always have the opportunity of appealing to council.
Okay, so I'm just wondering. I know Mr. Allen is here tonight, so I'm just wondering if he felt that he had no other recourse but to come to a public hearing and state his concern. So I want to just make sure folks who are coming in that are, and the community is doing a great job, and I think you said it rightfully, to be accurate, they're the ones that have conscientiously went out and conserved water, and a lot of these things they've done on their own. Someone asked a question about plumbers, and I know you're talking about modifying this program, but I thought I saw somewhere where it talked about people can hire their own plumbers, but they have to be certified, or are we going away from that?
We are looking for installation by a licensed plumber.
A licensed plumber.
A licensed plumber, right. So that requirement actually was built into the program way before the Stage 3, even before the Water Shortage Contingency Plan was implemented. The Cash for Grass program, as well as the Toilet Retrofit program, have been around for years and really been sitting mostly idle, to be honest with you. Very few retrofits have been done over the past. But through past experience, we found that toilets being installed by non-licensed plumbers or by homeowners are often installed ineffectively. They either leaked, they continue to use more water than they should because the valves weren't installed properly. And so there were problems associated with that. There were even claims associated with that relative to leaks and damages to property. So,
okay, because I was just wondering if there's a list of licensed plumbers in the city or in the five cities area, or are you just saying go hire someone as long as you can prove that they're licensed, that's acceptable?
So as it stands now, the city has qualified a list, and it's a very short list, which again is part of the problem with the backlog. We asked plumbers to come in and show us their capabilities and to show us that they had the proper insurance and everything else to be enrolled in a program where we're paying the plumber directly to do the work. Now what we're seeing is a rebate program. So a licensed plumber will come in with proof of installation and purchase and can get up to $100 for the toilet, and can get up to $100 rebate for their work to install the toilet. And so hopefully that answers your question.
Okay. Barbara,
that was what I was going to ask. Do you just take that on faith, or do you have to go in and do an inspection afterwards to be sure, number one, that it was a qualified toilet, and number two, that it was a qualified plumber?
We would be looking for receipts and some verification.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Jeff, you have a follow-up?
You got me stuck on the people versus the amount of water, and so it can kind of
my peripheral vision is still pretty good exactly. For an old basketball player.
It kind of led me down this path in my brain as other people were talking. It's like, so how much is our water conservation person? I'm assuming he's full time on this task, and then how much time and effort do you utilize for the granting or the consideration of waivers? And then if the community is conserving as much as it is in the programs that we have, and we have a small number of folks that are outside of the norm, and yet we're spending an inordinate amount of time on those cases to save a small amount of water, is this the best use of our resources?
Well, first, go ahead.
Okay, who? City Attorney.
Thank you, Honorable Mayor. And if I may respond, perhaps in general terms, just to the. You just turned it off. Thank you. In general terms, to the concept that was being proposed, it's not the measurement of the how much you've saved by or how much you're paying for saving the little bit that is being penalized. It's the concept of if you don't have those penalties in place, how many of the people who are currently complying aren't going to comply because there is no consequence mm-hmm. to non-compliance. And because we've dealt with similar issues in other jurisdictions, that's why the question kind of hit a point that I responded to in the past. Mm-hmm. And that's a measure. Places that have effective penalty programs generally show much greater levels of conservation faster than organizations that don't. I mean, our neighbors, for example, I think were an example of where they ultimately went into a actual penalty enforcement. Anyway, I hope that helps.
Mm-hmm. Well, I it helps, but I think, and we'll have to talk about this council is. Rather than making these statements we're just speculating, so maybe you need to do a survey. Maybe in one of these water bills you need to ask folks, what was your primary motivation for conserving? Was it sustainability? Was it I didn't want to get penalized? Because I think I prefer to be the guy that says the glass is half full rather than half empty. I'd like to say that, my goodness, 98% of the people have done this because it's the right thing to do versus saying that they did it under threat of penalty. I mean, let's do some survey and let's figure out what people really are thinking out there and what's their motivation. And I think that's something that we can talk about at another meeting or give some direction. Anyway, I know we've been talking about this item about an hour, so we got four items tonight. We're going to be here. We may have to make a motion to go past 11, but let's see where we're going. Okay, let me get focused again with respect to modifying the baseline water target. Staff, you identified that, and I think this speaks to the issue of, I don't know if it's Mr. Allen, but we had other folks who came and said, when we established this baseline and during the two building cycles that we used to establish their base number, they were either on vacation or out of the area and they've come back and been penalized. So you now, staff, you're saying you're not recommending any changes to baseline. So I just need to, I think that's something that is unfinished, and I would hoping you would have something here tonight. So can you kind of clarify why are you just saying, hey, the program's successful, we're not going to look at modifying baselines?
Well, so first of all, to be clear, we had to have something to compare to. And I know that virtually every agency that has attempted to adopt a water conservation program has struggled with this. It's nearly impossible to come up with a perfect solution. There really is no perfect solution. And we could say, hey, you're just allowed 50 gallons per person per day. We'd have to have some way to measure that, and we'd have to know exactly how many people are
in the city. But we're not at that point, because right? That's rationing.
Well,
so
even if we said 80 gallons per person per day, okay, we'd have to know how many people are in every house, and we'd have to know every day how many people are in that house.
So the program is, there's no perfect solution. It's flawed by its very nature. You can't find a perfect solution to this. But we looked at a number of different agencies, and basically we found out that most agencies are using a baseline period. And that is some period of water use in the person and the customer's past that exemplifies what normal water usage was throughout the year. And we simply chose the period beginning shortly after adoption of the program, which began in July of 2013 and spanned through the following June. So there's a baseline target usage, and we're looking for a reduction relative to that each billing period. So it's comparative. Winter, you use less water. Summer, you use more. So it compares. We internally adopted some standards, and that is that there are such low levels of water use that it doesn't justify us even issuing a courtesy letter. So there are very low levels. There's people out there. There's families of four using as little as 10.
What's that number? Can you?
Anything below 10, we're not even contemplating.
Okay. So for the folks in the audience, the folks at home, right. Is anything under 10 units of water is right. Used, correct?
And up to about 25 units of water, which we're finding to be a generous amount of water for a family of four. We're finding that almost everybody, literally almost everyone in the city, almost every family of four averages out to about 25 units per billing period. So we've established internally that in the neighborhood of 25 units per billing period, we're not likely to follow up with penalties. We're putting you very low on the priority list, and we're not getting there. We're spending the majority of our time on people that are using more than 25 units per billing period. And so, again, a lot of people are coming in at, 30s, 40s, 50s. We're okay. Seeing some pretty high numbers, surprisingly. But again, it's still a relatively small number.
Okay. And then, Bob, on page 5 of the staff report, you're reporting that a total of $97,708 spent on this program, and so in fiscal year 16 to date, we've expended a total of
56,
almost 57,000. So we're outpacing what was done last year. So is there a recommendation that we make a budget adjustment?
Because most
in
likely,
your fiscal impact statement, it didn't conclude anything.
When we and I don't recall the budget figure offhand, but we did increase the allocation this year. As a result of last year's experience, I think it was 100,000, and certainly at mid-year, if there's a need to add to that based on usage, we'll probably recommend that.
Okay, so maybe you could confirm, because if I'm adding the numbers up under fiscal impact, the 57,000, and then it says there's 28 left, doesn't come up to 100,000, so maybe you can confirm that.
Mayor, if I might, so looking at that program just quickly, we've expended almost 100,000 last year. We have in the neighborhood of the same amount available this year, but the biggest challenge we're having right now is we can't expend the money because we've developed a backlog in the program. So I think one thing that we may want to see, given that there's only 6 months left in the fiscal year, we may want to see how the proposed modifications affect that backlog, because we may not be able to expend the money unless the backlog can be reduced by these modifications.
Okay. But then my last comment is, and question is, I'm just wondering, this whole thing with the landscape must comply with development code, and I think it's confusing to a lot of us. And as a recovering planner, I understand that there are, and I see Bruce, he's not even in the room, so we're going to drag him in this room tonight. Because I want to know, for an R1, what are the lot coverage requirements? And when someone comes in, for example, myself, I live on a lot that I would imagine I'm not anywhere near the lot coverage requirement. So if I wanted to get involved in this cash for gas program, are you guys going to overanalyze me and discourage me from using this program? So what are the current standards?
Good evening, Council. Bruce Buckingham, Community Development Director. So let's just give you the example of an R1 lot.
Okay.
The maximum lot coverage for building is 45%. The minimum landscaping requirement is only 40%. So what can I tell you? That doesn't even up to 100%. We already allow, if you will, everybody's going to have a driveway. That's accounted for. It's not lot coverage, but it's not landscaping. So this really has never been an issue traditionally. People who construct a home have the maximum lot coverage quite typically. There's no issue with ever meeting those minimum landscape requirements. And as Greg alluded to, landscaping is a combination of patios, turf, mulch, rock. This issue really has only come to light because I think I would encourage the council not even to think of the development code for a moment. It's really the city is providing money to replace turf with something. And the question is what's appropriate and what do we want our neighborhoods to look like? Because we have had examples where we simply have a 50-foot front yard in this city, 20-foot driveway, you got 30 feet of landscaping. Someone has turf. They come in, it goes to entirely mulch or rock in one plant. So the real issue here is that acceptable to council? Yeah. Or in order to encourage people to remove turf, are we trying to get some landscaping, some aesthetic in return for that?
Okay. I mean, I understood that on the high level. So I'm just wondering, was there any thought of, do we adopt a severe drought exception to that? Now, I'm not saying that we let people pave out their entire front yard, but is there a way to simplify this? I mean, I can make the argument in my backyard if I wanted to go through this program, and even if I added something that was mostly impervious, the only place it's going to drain off is into my backyard. So I'm just kind of figuring out, is there a way to simplify this?
I'll defer to the public works director for standards of impervious versus pervious, because that becomes a drainage issue and having to capture that additional runoff on site.
Okay.
I would say, first of all, as a general rule, we don't regulate rear yards. People all the time buy a house that has landscaping. They come in, they build patios, they build decks. Those don't need permits. People can't see them.
Okay.
I think in general, what happens in a rear yard from a community development standpoint is a lot less important. I think the real issue is primarily that focus on the front yard and trying to get, or the question for the council is, do we want to try to get something that's green to replace the turf? The answer could simply be, no, we don't care what it is as long as you're, conserving water and you have no landscaping. But I think that's really the question for the council to consider tonight is, first of all, do we even want landscaping in return for removing turf, in my example of an all-turf front yard, which, is not uncommon.
Okay. So we're really focused on front yards, what's visible from a public way.
That's up to the council. What I'm saying is we're trying to develop a standard here for what is a replacement for lost turf. What I'm suggesting is maybe the council shouldn't be could have a different standard in a rear yard than they could a front yard.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay.
So, Mayor, if I might.
Yes.
So in Exhibit B, which is the proposed revised cash for grass rebate program, bullet 1, 2, 3, 4, bullet 5 in the revised program now says at least 40% of turf area replaced in front yards and or street side yards must be covered by drought tolerant plant materials. So unfortunately, it's a fine point that I did not identify in my oral report.
Yeah.
But it is in working this program and trying to develop this with assistance from the Community Development Department, we did indicate that, we're less concerned about what happens in the backyard. Still, relative to hardscaping, though, you have so many options for permeable hardscape. You could develop your entire backyard in pavers, but they could be permeable pavers, and you'd have no runoff retention requirement. So.
Okay, could I get some cash for my grass in my rear yard, or are you telling me I can't?
You could, if you apply for the program.
All right. Just making sure.
Can I ask a hypothetical?
Sure, why not?
Why not?
So, one question.
Sorry. So bullet point that talks about the city encourages use of local vendors, there's an asterisk in there called that states artificial turf is sold at this location. So if I go back to bullet point 5, and it says at least 40% of the turf area replaced in front yards, so forth, could I take out all of my turf and put in all AstroTurf, or would that not comply with this program?
That's a great question. I would say, as currently written, AstroTurf would not qualify as a drought-tolerant plant material.
And is AstroTurf considered impervious?
It is not impervious, okay. Although there are versions of installations for AstroTurf that are, in fact, impervious.
Okay.
They're impervious.
Okay, I know we've got folks still here to item 3. So let me open this up to the public. Mr. Allen, did you want to come back up and address the council on this item? Or I had heard a rumor that you had spoke with the city manager, and hopefully they've been responsive for you. But I do have a blue slip if you want to come back up.
Thank you for the opportunity to come back up. So yeah, the city manager did deliver a letter to me at the break that he hadn't gotten out prior to this, or I hadn't received prior to this meeting tonight. And the letter addressed my previous issues, but it didn't do anything to clarify or address the future. And that's, for me, the biggest concern here, and listening to the discussions we've had tonight, is as somebody that's trying to be as responsible as possible, and as at the lowest end of your guys' water usage, I average 17 units a month to the high, or per period, to the highest I've had in the last 12 months is 27. Oh. To receive two of these penalties, I am at the very low end of your guys' usage for this water consumption. And the education process for me in particular, my wife and I have had more than 8 interactions with city officials specifically designated to this. And more times than not, the communication to us has been fulfill the letter of the paperwork and not the conservation efforts of the paperwork, whereas take a picture of a toilet that is in compliance and send that in. It does not have to be my toilet. Which was clarified. So the desire here needs to be for true conservation within the community and not meeting the letter of the standard on paper. And that's my biggest concern, because I want to be a responsible community member, but it needs to be described properly. It needs to be educated properly on how we can achieve these things. At no point in time did anybody offer to dialogue with me about any of my other opportunities and what I haven't taken advantage of in situations. For me, myself, going from 2 household incomes to 1 household income, it is hard to spend large dollars to get small returns, right, when I'm already at a small savings amount. You know, the amount of money I have to put out to buy a new washing machine in order to get the savings, the rebate isn't quite there. So for me, it doesn't fiscally make it possible for my family. Along with all of these other options and opportunities, I'm not looking at saving large amounts of water. I mean, you know, I could save, you know, just not quite a unit in buying a new washing machine, but that doesn't necessarily change anything. And the other thing that I want to bring up is that our first penalty was for we had used 26 units of water. That was our first penalty. I don't know if I used 25 units and 3 gallons, or if I use 25 units and 700 gallons of water. There's a large delta there. And so for me, being at the very low end of this and it being very difficult to have such large unit quantities is a very hard thing for us to understand as a community member. So that's
all right. Thank you.
Thank you.
And I think I have a request form from, I think, Brad Snook.
Thank you, Mayor. Brad Snook, co-chair of our county's chapter of the Surfrider Foundation. A couple kind of clarifications that the council was asking for early on, centered around, you know, retention and landscape retention. I was glad to see the word retention
pop up here. Our Ocean Friendly Gardens program focuses on three elements: conservation, permeability, and retention. And for the city, from the city's perspective, the retention element also ties into the stormwater management program. So if you're saying that you want 40% to be 40% of the draining landscape to be retentive, you know, of stormwater, you also want to look at that from the city's next project, which is the streets, what we can do to make the streets more, you know, so you're walking the walk also. Makes sense. From a certification and training perspective, for people that are not landscapers or don't spend a lot of time looking at other people's landscapes, and they're saying, I want to get into this cash for grass thing. Sounds cool to me. It makes sense. I want to conserve water. I want to trim down to 15 units instead of where I'm at with 20. Because when we started this whole drought, the average landscape was using about 40% of residential. We thought probably between 30 and 40. And so once the landscape's turned over, that's long-term conservation. That's getting us towards that sustainability and that buffer that we want, because that landscape will now be saving, will be conservation year after year after year. And maybe they're looking at their other lawn after that and saving even more next year. So that's what we want. We have a 3G training that I can turn the city on to. It's basically off-the-shelf training that would allow kind of a conservation school, sort of like what AG is doing with their program, and you know, certainly the city knows where to. Their first presentation is, I think, $10,000, but they can bring in a whole audience and get them in for that, or you can go to their existing training and you can send somebody from the city down there to bring back the training materials and then train others. So there's a couple different approaches to it. Thank you.
Thank you, Brad. I don't have any other speaker request form, so bring it back to the council. So, there's a resolution in staff that talked about some modifications to the program, so let's see how we feel about this. I think there was a discussion about mandatory training program, and that's for people that, is that as those who get the notice or the penalty that you were discussing?
It was one of the optional modifications that staff had identified, primarily because our neighboring agency offers an automatic waiver if you attend mandatory water conservation training. We've approached it in a slightly different manner. If you receive your first courtesy notice, you get water conservation brochure and information on where to find more water conserving tips, and information on the website. And so we're not recommending that we fund or implement a mandatory conservation training program as a modification, and we just identified it as council could consider it. The modifications recommended tonight are entirely related to the two programs, the fixture retrofit and the cash for grass.
Okay. So anyone in the house have any thoughts regarding this? You said automatic waiver, someone entered into a mandatory training program.
I don't think there should be any automatic waivers, and I don't know if we're going to go through this whole section. I'll just make I have one comment on the whole section.
Well, make your comment.
I do believe the penalties, I know you like to look at the glass half full, but the penalties made me notice, being from the Midwest and not really
being an attorney,
understanding,
being a lawyer,
and not understanding conservation. The penalty did make our family notice and understand and start conserving. I find the doubling and tripling penalty to be oppressive, because maybe people are trying to figure things out. They're certainly at this point, they've had the education, and maybe someone in Mr. Allen's situation, where if for some reason he didn't get a waiver, for his wife's health, just says, you know what, we're going to do the 100%. But, and that's so few people, I think, that would elect to keep getting 100%. I think the 200 and 300% just becomes kind of crazy. So that's my comment on the whole thing. I know that that's not even on the table right now, but that was that.
Okay.
And as far as education...
Oh, what? There's more?
Well, we talked about education. I did not know that 25 units per a family of four was what you'd be shooting for. All I know is we're reduced. It might be as simple as including in people's water bill, this is what you should shoot for.
Okay.
That's a good idea. Mr. Mayor?
Yes?
I just want to clarify, although these modifications are not necessarily recommended, it is still subject to council action, and should the council wish to move forward with any particular of those modifications, that's a council decision.
Thank you for that clarification. That's where I was trying to go. So let's do this. So staff, these are your recommended modifications, so let's see how we feel about those first. Let's do that. So basically, you're talking about the retrofit and rebate program. This is what plumbing fixture, the cash for grass, the $100 for the toilet, the $100 for the plumber.
Would you like me to just run through them really quickly?
So
basically, the modifications for the plumbing retrofit would include allowing private purchase of toilets, continue with the $100 valuation of that, but it'd be a rebate now. Allow the participants to choose their own plumber, again, a licensed plumber. Provide verification, we rebate $100 for that also. Allow commercial customers to enroll in the program, but as a result require that they employ waterless urinals. Prioritize the applications. As you know, there's about $100,000 available. We don't know what will happen if we didn't have the backlog. It could be that we get all the applications in and completely fill up the available funding early in the program.
Keep going.
Prioritize them as you see. Single family, multifamily, commercial urinals and apartments with 3.5 gallons or more toilets existing, all others to follow. Moving to the cash for grass program, it's primarily trying to clarify some common questions and misconceptions about the program that you must comply with the development code. We're looking for 40% plant material coverage in the area replaced. Retention requirements would still continue to apply. These are the changes that we're recommending, and with the clarification that we're really looking for the 40% in the front or side street side yards, the visible parts of the yard.
Okay. How does everyone feel about those recommendations?
I have a question.
Okay.
The waterless urinals, do they fall within that $100 rebate cost frame?
That would be the plan, yeah.
Okay, great.
Okay. Follow-up question to that.
Sure.
If an existing business or whoever wants to put in a waterless urinal, the city does not have a requirement to do anything but cap off the water line, correct? They don't need to remove the water supply to the area of the now waterless urinal, correct?
No, there's no such requirement.
Okay,
no.
Good. And the only reason I say that is just from anecdotal experience, I'm hearing that if people put in waterless urinals in locations about 2 to 3 years from now, they will go, not quite sure if that worked, and some of them are putting back in low flow urinals. So I don't know if you've heard that as well.
Historically, there's been some dissatisfaction with waterless urinals. The technology has improved greatly. Mr. Fine is in the audience here. I noticed that they have a requirement now at the City of Pismo Beach for all commercial or all businesses to install waterless urinals, and there's a time period on that, I believe. Yeah. So it's the technology is there today. The satisfaction with those is considerably greater than it had been, and the water savings is significant. So on the
compliance side of it, I think if we saw people putting back normal urinals, their water use would increase significantly, and they would be penalized, you know, under the current program.
Okay. So. One thing towards that same end, though, if we do have new and this is more of an advocacy position from that perspective. Okay. If we did go with the waterless urinals, I wouldn't want to have a condition or I wouldn't want the city to mandate people that they couldn't put water into that area. So in the event that a lower flow fixture for urinals was available in the future, so that because then obviously there's a significant retrofit that would need to be necessary to go from a waterless 100% waterless urinal to a watered urinal.
Well, it's not in the terms and conditions.
Exactly.
So I think we're good on that end.
Yeah, but if it ever gets into the building code, so
I see in the building code. Okay, yeah. Well,
is my thought there?
Gotcha.
Okay.
I don't know if you want to go somewhere else first, or I can continue with comments.
You have the floor.
Okay, cool. So I'm supportive of the changes of the retrofit program. So I'm a little confused with regards to the cash for grass modifications. No matter what we do with this, I'd like to take the – I'm not sure what number bullet it is, but where it says it's the bullet that starts the cash for grass rebate application must be submitted to the city of Grover Beach, and the applicant must participate in a pre-conversion site review conducted by the city prior to removal of any lawn. Can we put that like somewhere at the top in huge letters and bold so that people, if they're doing any research on the cash for grass program, find that very early on in the process.
What document are you looking at? Exhibit A?
It would be Exhibit B.
Exhibit B.
I think it's like the fifth bullet, or one, two, three, four, five, sixth third. Bullet from the bottom.
A third down.
Or a third down from the top on the second page. It's all about perspective. So I just feel that should be larger and somewhere identified to that.
So I think that's a direction for staff to maybe modify this.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea.
This one cut.
Makes sense.
Overall, I'm not quite sure this is going where it's going to make it any easier for people, though. So,
well, I mean, I think that's a good suggestion. I think that's more direction, not so much a change in the program per se.
No, I mean, I think these changes to the program, I don't know if I think there's – we've generated enough questions up here that I don't know if it's going to be easier for – or perhaps this – maybe these are the tools that staff needs to make it easier when someone comes to the counter.
I think the general direction is to simplify this, make it easier for people to understand terms and conditions, and we'll have to leave that to staff to – and I think take that into it under advisement. I think what I'm trying to work toward is there's a resolution in front of us. They've made some suggested changes, and it sounds like we support all except there's still some questions regarding this cash for grass program, and I'm not sure if there's a way to just – I'm still trying to figure out how to – because I think Bruce said is right. The intent is we certainly want people to replace turf with drought – tolerant landscaping, and we don't want to see front yards that are completely porous favors. Completely impervious surfaces. So, if staff is confident that this will make it simpler for folks to get into this program, then I'm going to support it. But I want to monitor it and come back sooner rather than later. Because
Are we in a – I don't support the changes. Now that I understand these changes, I don't support these changes because I think, if I'm understanding correctly, the cash for grass program is becoming way – more strict than our own building code. Our own zoning code says 40% of our yard can be landscaping as long as it's – what is pervious is takes in the water. Okay, so as long as it's pervious. Mm-hmm. So you could have 40% of your landscaping as pervious pavers. But now this is saying 40% of whatever you replace has to be plants.
40% of the turf.
Of the turf that you replace has to be plants. Well, it's cash for grass, so that's what you'd be taking out. Mm-hmm. So 40% of what you're replacing has to be plants, but really that just, I don't know, nowhere in our code does it say any of it has to be plants. 40% of my yard could be pervious pavers. Yep. I think we're being more oppressive than our code. I don't, Bruce? Unless I'm missing something.
Yes, City Attorney.
Presumably, the 100% of what we're replacing, the lawn, is part of the 20% that was dedicated to landscaping. So you're taking something that is 100% landscaping and telling them that they can put 40% plants. So you're actually decreasing
the number of plants.
In theory, okay. the requirement. Because what you're replacing is 100% landscaping.
Okay.
Because it's part of the 20% that is required under the code, presumably.
Did he get that right?
Yeah, I'll repeat it for.
But if you read the definition, landscaping includes all these different things, which, yes, plants are one of them, but also pavers and whatnot. I just think whatever it is, this is, as someone who's contemplating using it, I don't think I will use it because I don't understand. I think I understand, but in my mind, having to rip out grass and put in plants will actually use more water up front to get the plants going. So I'm not as inclined to even push to do it. Just telling you as a person who's thinking of
okay.
it. May I make a suggestion?
Sure.
Come over and look at my neighbor's front yard who just got a cash for grass thing and redid it. It's beautifully done.
Okay.
And it's a very small space. And it's very comfortable.
Bruce?
You really want me to say anything else?
Well,
Councilmember Nichols brings up a good point. You know, half the people that come in and do this program, they're into landscaping. They spend months designing, and they are meticulous. There's a smaller percentage of people that I have indicated. They just want to remove their turf, but they don't want to replace it with any landscaping. They just want it to be rock or mulch. And that's what you end up in a front yard is looking and seeing mulch and rock. Mm-hmm. So to answer your question, Councilmember Shaw, I would throw out all comparisons of the development code. Someone that comes in, We're not reviewing their entire site plan to see if they're complying with the city's development code. It's just simply we're trying to encourage people to remove turf and replace it with something different. And all this is going to say is that if you remove X amount of turf, 40% of that area that you had landscaping with turf now needs to be replaced with some kind of drought-tolerant landscaping. That when it matures, it will cover 40% of the area that used to be turf. Now they've got 60% of the area they can do other things with. Mm-hmm. And they're still going to be in compliance with the development code. Okay.
As long as they're porous in nature, not impervious.
Again, they can be impervious, but they just need to have on-site retention.
Right.
The part that may, there's some history as to why the city requires only 50% hardscape coverage in your front yard. We have 50-foot lots. If you have a 20-foot driveway, and then you decide, well, I want to park cars on both sides of my driveway, all of a sudden it was 35 or 40 feet wide. You had no landscaping left in the front yard. Right. And that took away, again, from the intent of trying to have some kind of an aesthetic front yard. So that's the history behind that.
Well, I think we know where everyone finishes
on
this.
I would like to see how it plays out. I just think this needs to be much clearer because I wouldn't want people to expend money thinking they're going to get the money back and they're not. So just as long as I guess we'll see how it plays out.
Yeah, we'll have to see.
Okay, well, I haven't had my say and I'd like to if you don't mind.
Sure.
Okay. So I agree with the plumbing, the fixture retrofit and rebate. I do agree that if the city is paying for your cash for grass replacement, then the standards that are set should have to be met. If you want to do it yourself, you want to put all rocks in your front yard, then you go ahead and do that. But so I do agree with that part. I do think that this is for somebody, you know, luckily I was on the Planning Commission for a bazillion years, and so I kind of get all that. But and even then, I'm kind of confused, you know, so I'm thinking maybe when you say requirements of the City Development Code, maybe you could have some, like a cheat sheet that says this is what we mean, you know, not just the City Development Code. Who knows what that is? Nobody. I mean, unless you're a geek like some of us. The rest of us, most people don't know, and they really don't care. They only care because they're doing this thing. So I think if you could make this a little less clinical, for lack of a better word, and certainly use
that's a good point.
Mayor Pro Tem's suggestion of putting the third bullet down on the back page at the top. And I don't know, do you require some kind of a plan to say, okay, this is going to work?
Yes, okay. They require a plan. We review the plan in advance and give you, you know, the feedback on it if it doesn't comply with the requirements or approve it, and then it's a
so the people inspection. Who aren't familiar with all these terms and what landscaping could be, plants and hardscape, blah blah blah, you're there to look at their plan and say you need to fix this, you need to change this, that sort of thing.
We provide assistance.
Okay, yes. Then, in light of that, then I would be in agreement with the Cash for Grass program revisions.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you for those comments. So I think we're almost there. Marion brought up a good question regarding the fixed penalty adjustment, and I don't know if we need to make a decision on that tonight, because I do agree that this escalating going from 100% to 200% to 300% is, what was the word you used?
Oppressive.
Maybe just not fair. I don't know. Because I still believe the vast majority of people are doing this not because of threat or penalty. So if there's a way we can, I want to see where everyone else is on that. Do you leave it the way it is, or do we want to look at trying to adjust what that penalty is, making it a fixed number?
Okay, I'm going to go.
I personally don't find any need. I think it could be adjusted down the line as we see how this whole program plays out over a year's period of time.
I think I agree with Miriam. I think that people are going to do it because they want to. Really making the penalty more and more, I think, is just going to be a hardship and really just make people mad. So I think through a combination of education and just getting people on, they have to be on board, or some people just aren't ever going to be. You know, I see that in my neighborhood. There are people who just, they don't care. They don't understand, or they just don't get it, or whatever it is. But I think that we could certainly look at just the penalty is what it is, and it doesn't get any higher. Just you keep paying it.
So setting it at the 100%, or is it a different breakdown?
I would think 100%. I mean, how could you really set a, you know, for somebody who maybe, like me, I use two units. Say I go to four, and somebody who uses 50 units, they go to 60, and we get charged the same penalty. I don't think that's really, so I think if you stay at the, that it's relative to the amount of water that they use.
Okay. So maybe we give some, okay, so maybe we need to give some direction to staff on that, because I don't think we can come up with an actual number tonight, and I don't think we've been given enough information. Jeff?
And actually, I was going to say, I'm more in agreement with Councilmember Nichols than Councilmember Brights and Shaw for a couple different reasons, one of which is I think the numbers do show that there is some success, but I like your idea of when this comes forward, asking the people what is it that is the driving force for that. And so short of having a little bit of that information, the quasi-selfish reason for this is that if we do change these penalty structure right now, there's probably a whole cascading series of documentation at the city that may need to change. And then if we, in another 6 months, if we finalize that, then we may end up cascading that and making additional changes and staff work to do that. So I'd be acceptable keeping them at this level, asking the water conservation personnel to ask the question as to what's the driving force and come back with that information.
Okay.
That makes sense.
And then last thing, Greg, on this issue of businesses, was that another thing we talked about is waiving any penalties provided they adopt a water conservation plan? Is that, or we haven't formally adopted that?
That's not formally adopted. And you know, within the program, staff has some leeway in how they implement the program. And that's how, you know, staff has the ability to issue waivers at an administrative level. And so how we're currently administering the waiver program relative to businesses is saying you may be eligible for a waiver if you accept the education and go through the development of a conservation program and follow it. And so I don't think we need to modify the program to do that. One option, though, is that council could just simply exempt businesses from the penalties.
I'll just throw it out there. I don't think I'd be supportive of that because that's kind of benefiting the businesses over the residents.
Right. I agree.
Resident.
Agreed.
So,
okay, so not exempting businesses, but this water. I think there's some validity in this water conservation plan because I think when this came forward to us before, I'm sure several of us got an email or call from AJ Spurs and the shopping center in which Spoon Trade is in, has been dealing with this situation. So this is my whole point from earlier to say you can talk percentages all you want. Give me numbers and tell me who is impacted by this. So what we don't want to do is have a program that is having an effect on businesses that just by the nature of being successful run into these challenges. Now, I don't say we waive it, but I think they need to have a water conservation plan in place.
Yeah, that makes excellent sense. I agree with that. But just a blanket waiver, I don't think is the right thing to do.
Okay.
That's the wrong message, I think.
So then why don't we do this? I'm trying to figure out how to get. Let's move forward with this, with the resolution and the recommended changes by staff. If there's any modifications, please make that motion. And then we give some direction regarding these two items, the fixed penalty adjustment and the issue of how we want to deal with businesses. Fair enough? Who's brave enough to try a motion on this item?
And actually, before I make the motion, I was going to add one more item to the cash for grass. It's kind
you
of a
just had kind to of, go there.
Kind of a clarification.
You have the floor.
And if everyone's
if you don't like it, don't second it. Go for it.
And if the agreement is okay, then I'll move forward with the motion. I'm going back to my artificial turf comment. So can we add a clarification that if they replace like for like, if they do turf with 100%. Pervious turf, that is acceptable. So you,
sure.
then you don't have to worry about the 40% of turf area being replaced with drought tolerant plant. If it's green for green,
pervious.
So make your motion.
I don't know how to
make a motion.
Okay, great. Then let me get back to the point here, and it's I'm going to make a motion that we adopt the resolution modifying the city's water conservation programs regarding the plumbing fixture water conservation retrofit program and the cash for grass water conservation rebate program with, do I go as generic as with direction as discussed?
Your motion.
Okay, then I'll go a little bit more specific.
Oh, so, I thought you were going to go generic.
Okay, I'll go generic then, with consensus direction and input from council.
Is that clear on what the changes or the
yes.
So, the sand, which is a pervious surface,
But it's not green. It's not green. Oh, green? Sure. No, I don't know.
I think I'm. If this is helpful, my understanding is we move this one particular bullet item about the application requirement to the first position and make it bold. That we, to the extent possible, simplify and make this easier to understand within the same requirements, but make it more clear. And we add a clarification that artificial turf will be considered plant material for the purposes of these modifications. Pardon me?
Pervious.
Pervious artificial turf.
Okay. So that's a motion. Was that a second?
I'll second that.
Okay. There's a motion and a second. Any more discussion on the motion?
Please.
Roll call.
Yes.
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 Yes. And then is there a consensus to give staff direction to return with discussion on the fixed penalty adjustment as well as formally adopting a program that would waive penalties for businesses provided they adopt a water conservation plan?
I would make that motion with the timing such that it's either, and I don't know if we can tie this to the utility discussion, the rate discussion as well. I don't know if that's the appropriate time to do it, or within 6 months.
I think either or. Is everyone in agreement with that?
Yeah.
It's just direction.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Motion.
Okay. Are we okay with that, given direction on that, city attorney, or do we need a motion on that?
No.
We're good? Okay. Wow. Such with a short evening, but, you know, important topics, I mean, I'm going to say. So let's move on to item number 3. And, Greg, when you're ready, staff report, please.
So the next two items are fairly simple items. Both are discussions regarding participation in potential water supply projects. So in particular, if you recall, at the October 19th, 2015 City Council meeting, the Public Works Director from the City of Pismo Beach, Ben Fine, presented the results of a grant-funded recycled water facilities planning study and how that study had indicated that there are potential regional benefits for use of recycled water that is currently being treated at the City of Pismo Beach Wastewater Treatment Plant. And they had requested at that time that council authorize staff to work collaboratively with the City of Pismo Beach and other interested parties in development of a recycled water project and a governance system for a regional groundwater sustainability program. And so you've heard information both from Engineer Gehring and myself about the city's status of our water supplies. I think council understands that we do have a need to contemplate a long-term supply of water. Recycled water certainly is an option that can be and should be considered. I think it's safe to say that this project is in a development stage. We don't know the upfront costs yet. We have some estimates based on current studies of what the cost per acre feet of water might be. I would say that they're more than we pay for water from the Lopez Water Project currently. But at the same time, based on studies that have been done for other potential long-term water supplies, I think they're within the range of acceptable costs for an additional water supply. And so really to just jump forward to a recommendation, I think staff is recommending that council authorize staff formally to express interest in this, the City of Pismo Beach recycled water project, as well as possibly a regional solution to a project that's being considered by the City of Arroyo Grande. And we only have a request from the City of Pismo Beach for council to authorize us to express interest and to work collaboratively with them in development of this project. And as of yet, it's too soon to tell whether we would ultimately be engaged with the project, but that's the point of working collaboratively, I think, with the cities, is to work together toward determining what the ultimate and best solution might be, how that might best benefit the city of Grover Beach, and ultimately to identify costs and determine if it's a cost that we can afford and support. So with that, my recommendation, or staff's recommendation, is to formally express interest in the recycled water projects identified by staff and authorize staff to work collaboratively with other participating agencies in the development of one or more regional recycled water projects. And I will add again that Director Fine is here from the City of Pismo Beach if you have any questions regarding their project in particular.
Very good. Any questions of staff? None to my left? No? Any questions?
No.
Mayor Pro Tem?
Actually, I just have one question. So the probably two. The scalping plant, is that being driven by Rio Grande or the Sand District? Or is it still to be determined?
Initially, it was driven by the city of Rio Grande. It is becoming integrated with issues at the Sand District and ultimately may result in a recommendation that it become more of a regional recycled water project that could involve the Sand District more directly.
That is correct.
Okay. And the second question is actually for City Engineer Fine. If he had, I don't know if he's going to come up and speak, I can ask him when he comes at that point.
Yeah, you want to do, let's do that.
Okay.
Okay. Just one sec, man. Okay. Barbara, do you have any questions?
No.
Okay. I don't have any questions. I'm going to open this up to the public. And now, Mr. Fine, if you'd like to come up and you'd like to ask your question.
Sure. So, and thank you for joining us and being patient with us as we go forward. The question I have is, where is your recycled water project in its process?
It should be on.
Is the mic on?
There is.
Yeah. Okay. No light. I was confused. Sorry. So we have awarded a contract for the environmental work, and we will be taking an item to our city council at our meeting on the 15th to award a contract for a design engineer. We're currently working with that engineer. It's WSC. And part of the contract is to facilitate the governance meetings. And we anticipate that the first such meeting will be in January. We're trying to schedule a date this month. This month's almost over, so in the next couple of weeks, pick a date. But the first meeting would be in January.
Hmm. So which then leads to a second question is, are they doing the environmental process as well, or would that be a separate contract?
That's a separate contract with SWCA.
SWCA, okay. And then, so with regards to...
No, you're good. She's. Okay. I heard. She's talking to me.
With regards to the governance meetings, so if we did move forward with participating collaboratively on the project, what level of participation would you be looking for from the city on those governance meetings?
Full participation. So we envision WSC Jeff Seitel will be facilitating those meetings. And our expectation is that all interested parties would participate. I don't know who from Grover would be representing Grover, but we would expect that everybody would be at the table. There's a lot of different things to hash out. How much water does everybody want? How much does everybody pay in? How's it operated? How's it funded? All sorts of different questions.
Maybe going back to the first part of your answer there is it anticipated that it would be staff level or policy level or both?
That is a good question. I would anticipate that it would be both. So maybe one elected and a staff. More details to come.
Okay. Great. That's one.
Okay. Councilmember Bright, yes, you.
Thank you. Thank you for being here. Appreciate you hanging out for so long. Does your city intend to go forward whether or not AG and South San or whoever is going to run that scalping project or whatever we're calling it, scalping plant? Do you intend to go forward either way?
Absolutely. So we have hired an environmental firm, mm-hmm. and we're going to hire an engineering firm, and we are looking to move the project forward. Both Oceano and Rio Grande have both formally committed to investigate moving forward with us and, you know, coming to the governance meetings and participate. There's a lot to figure out between mm-hmm. now and an absolute yes, we're going to do this.
Right.
And is this right for your agency, and is it right for the region?
But as far as Pismo Beach is concerned, you think that this is the way to go on with your own project as opposed to branching off or utilizing South Sand facilities that are already there?
So from our point of view, our project is quite a few years ahead of a South County project.
I see.
And we really don't have time, mm-hmm. Current drought situations, to wait for South County sand to catch up. One of the options we've been investigating is some type of modular plant, maybe not located in Pismo, at some other site, and it could be scalable so that at some point in time when South County sand is ready to move forward with such a project, it can be expanded and treat all the water.
Interesting.
So that's one of the things that we've been investigating. We have certain issues at our wastewater treatment plant site, just like South County does, and that is, one, the Coastal Commission, and two, the floodplain. So
right.
We have been investigating other options, but okay. We are moving forward full steam with recycled water.
Terrific. Thank you very much.
Okay. And, Ben, did you have any specific comments that you want to make to the council?
I don't. I just appreciate you guys considering the item, and, I think this is an excellent opportunity for the region, for the South County, to bring a reliable, sustainable, drought-proof supply of water, which is much needed. So thank you for your consideration.
Great. Thank you. I think I have one more other speaker request, one from Mr. Snook.
Good evening, Council. Brad Snook, co-chair of the County's Chapter Surfrider Foundation. We're big fans because besides the gray water reuse that people can do on their own properties, this is the first recycling program in this part of the county. And what it does is it allows us to create that buffer towards sustainability so we can have that discussion at a later point. One point I have made in front of a Pismo City Council having to do with the Northern Cities Management Area and the grouping of staff, carrying that message to the councils. If you don't have an elected official there at the meetings when they're laying down all these plans and having all these discussions, it would be good to have all the councils, all the different cities, get the same message at the same time, so some document gets carried out mm-hmm. to the groups so that they don't just disperse into the wind and then everybody gets something that's sort of similar but not really the same. So long term, that's what I'm thinking. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Sorry, no blue form. Ron Riley, Manhattan Avenue in Grover Beach. And I just want to say that I can't stress how heavily it weighs on my family and I that saltwater intrusion is literally something that could happen any day now. As most of us as residents here, nearly all of us residents here, we're talking about 2 and 3 years of probable water. And we're talking about 5 and 10 year mm-hmm. solutions. And I feel like we need to arm ourselves with as many of those solutions, including conservation, as quickly as possible. All we're asking today is to formally commit to talking about being a part of this. We're not asking to adopt anything today. So I would ask the council to think about what weighs on our families' minds and encourage you to adopt this resolution today.
So. Great. Thank you, Mr. Riley. Okay, with that, I'll bring it back to the council. Do we want to have some discussion, or are someone prepared to make a motion on this item?
I'll make a motion if there's no discussion.
Okay.
Okay. Then I make a motion that we authorize staff to formally express interest in the city of Pismo Beach and? Okay. Mm-hmm. And the SSLOCSD recycled water facilities to work collaboratively with other participating agencies in the development of one or more regional recycled water projects.
Okay, very good.
A second.
There's a motion, there's a second. Any discussion on the motion?
Only, I'm going to support this, but I think this gives an opportunity for the a more regional partnership and opportunity to discuss and communicate with other members of Zone 3 and our neighboring cities and Oceano and other districts as well. So I think it has a dual opportunity there to have a recycled water project and communication amongst all the members and all the regional partners.
Well, hopefully that is the end result.
Right.
Yep.
But I also don't think that we should be limited to just those two projects.
Well, fair enough. I think all options remain on the table.
Right.
Okay. So there's a motion. There's a second. If there's no additional discussion, we can do this first. There's no resolution. So let's do voice vote. All in favor?
Aye.
All opposed? None. Motion carries. Again, Mr. Fine, thank you for being here tonight. And nice work, staff. So we'll keep all options on the table as it relates to short-term and long-term water supplies.
Before we leave that item,
okay.
If there is going to be potential for meetings in January, as early as January, do we need to either have part of the discussion tonight with regards to who's going to represent the city, or do we have staff bring that back at another meeting?
Why don't we have staff bring it back? Maybe we can do it. We can do our committee assignments early, and that can be part of the discussion. City manager.
Yes, Mr. Mayor. In fact, I was going to advise you that my intent is to schedule or stay with our normally scheduled council meeting December 21st.
Okay.
We would probably do committee appointments at that time.
Then that'll work. Okay. Let's move on to item number 4.
Fortunately, another swift item. This is a request from the county for confirmation of interest in the Zone 3 emergency water supply project. So quick background, the Director of Public Works from the County of San Luis Obispo sent a letter dated October 15th to the City of Grover Beach requesting a formal endorsement, I'm using their words, formal endorsement of interest in a Zone 3 emergency water supply project. And for explanation, the project involves using desalinated seawater from a treatment plant that's currently located at PG&E's Diablo Canyon Power Plant project. The project, according to the county, as an emergency supply project, has the potential to deliver between 500 and 1,000 acre feet per year of water to the South County region. So again, you've heard potential drought conditions, potential short-term critical shortfall of water supply. As proposed by the county, this is a short-term solution. The idea, again, is to bring water from the Diablo Canyon Power Plant, which has an existing operating desalination facility, to pipe that water into the Lopez pipeline system, which currently, as you know, brings water from Lopez Lake down and all the way to nearly Diablo Canyon Power Plant. It brings it all the way to the Port San Luis Avila Beach area and then east of there to some of the rural water customers. So the pipeline's there nearly at the entrance to Diablo Canyon's power plant, and which is fortunate. Pushing water the wrong way in a pipeline system or opposite way in a pipeline system does have its challenges, and the county is currently studying the feasibility of the project and probable costs and time frames. I'm sure Councilmember Lee knows as much, if not more, about this than I do. But so correct me if I'm wrong about any of this information. But again, it's sort of too soon to tell to what extent this would benefit the city of Grover Beach. I mean, clearly, if it's an affordable and reliable source of emergency water that could be available nearly immediately or in the very short term, short near future, the city should definitely express interest. Again, pending a determination of what exactly participation in the project means in terms of costs and commitments. I also want to note, though, that the Zone 3 Technical Advisory Committee, at our last Technical Advisory Committee meeting, did advise County Zone 3 staff that, you know, we want to think of this as a long-term project, and there's benefits of doing that. One, we recognize the need for a long-term and reliable source of additional water to improve reliability of our current water supplies, but we also recognize that by spreading the costs of this project over a longer time period, it's likely to be more cost-effective for the city. So that's the short and sweet of it. Staff's recommendation is simply to do as the letter requests, and that is council provide direction to staff to develop a letter for the mayor's signature to the County Board of Supervisors with a copy to the County Department of Public Works formally endorsing the city's interest in the Zone 3 Emergency Water Supply Project. And that concludes my very brief presentation.
Thank you, Greg. And in the interest of transparency, I want to make sure people understand I do work for PG&E. This is a county project, as I understand it, and I am not part of any PG&E leadership team that has been negotiating or making any decisions on behalf of that company. So I just wanted to be completely transparent on that. I think tonight you're just basically asking the council to keep all options open, correct? Okay. Any questions of staff?
Well, may I say that our last Zone 3 meeting, I was advised by the City of Pismo, as well as, I believe, Oceano Community Services District. They submitted a letter saying that they would be interested in hearing more about the project, but really until, I didn't see the letters, what I gleaned from what the representatives there said is that rather than making somewhat of a commitment to the project, certainly conveying our interest in the project or their interest in the project, but until there was more information, they couldn't really do a formal commitment or whatever. And I've given that a great deal of thought, and then after reading the staff report, that seems to make sense to me. But I do have some questions aside from that announcement.
You want to go ahead and make your... Go ahead and ask
your
questions.
Of course. So then, Mr. Ray, 500 to 1,000 acre feet a year, that just doesn't seem like much water to me. I mean, I guess if it could recharge maybe the groundwater or something, but...
Well, so...
I'm concerned about the cost for that small amount of water.
Right. So we don't know really what the cost is yet. There have been some very rough estimates made, and the cost seems to be, again, in keeping with what we didn't expect. But as an example, it's potentially a regional emergency water supply. So let's say that the county could develop it within a year. And let's say within a year that the city of Grover Beach is the only agency that finds itself missing one or more of its water supplies. I don't know how that would happen uniquely, but let's just say for discussion. Then 500 to 1,000 acre feet would be pretty significant because that would exactly match either of our two current water supplies as far as what we're using, not as far as what's available.
Right.
But so it could be significant in that regard. If four agencies each take 500 acre feet or 250 acre feet, if it's 1,000, as a permanent supply, it's not that significant. But I think if the cost is right and it makes sense, even a couple hundred acre feet could make the difference of tiding us over for a half a year if necessary. So,
okay, well, that makes sense to me. Yeah. If the cost is right, then my one last question then is, would, to your knowledge then, would you say that the bulk of the cost is moving the water the wrong way, since the pipe is already there, and so on?
No.
So what is the bulk of the cost then?
Now, I think it would. The bulk of the cost would involve the somewhat slight expansion of the existing facility at Diablo Canyon and the pipeline from the treatment plant all the way to the gate.
Which is approximately 7 miles.
Oh, I thought you said it was to the doorway or something.
Well, we are to the doorway, but the doorway is 7 miles away from the plant. Yes.
That's gotcha. That's why I was smiling when he was saying it's really close to the plant. It's just not close to where the water is.
Where the water is. Right. Gotcha. Okay, well, that answers that question. Okay, thank you.
Okay. Miriam, any questions?
None from me, no. Thank you.
To my right?
No.
Barbara? No? Did you say yes or no?
No, actually,
I thought he said no.
Oh, my goodness.
I have to get out my camera.
Actually, it's a very easy question, actually. So, notwithstanding any public comment that comes forward that sways us in a different direction, I'm supportive of going towards interest, but I want to make sure that we do represent back to the county that we would be relying upon their advantages probably isn't the right word, but their grant opportunities, whether it be USDA, IRWM, Prop 1B, any level of state and federal funding opportunities that would reduce the out-of-pocket expense for the Grover Beach or the other Zone 3 participants. Mm-hmm. So I think we need to keep that in the fashion of the letter.
Makes sense.
So, yeah. And then the Greg, from what I'm hearing is there's going to be a discussion at the board level somewhere towards the end of January on this topic. Do you happen to know that date?
Sorry, I don't know the date. I do know in talking, you know, John Hollenbeck, who's also a consultant to the city, has been working on part of that investigation. I do know it's, I believe, late January is the proposed date, but I don't know exactly.
Okay, because I think that the letters of interest are intended to be used at that meeting. Is that your understanding? So that it kind of shows the support of the communities to the board.
That's what the letter says. Okay. And they want to have them prior
by December 15th is okay. What the letter is requesting.
That's it? I don't have any questions. Let me open this up to the public. Mr. Snook.
Thank you, Mayor. Brad Snook from Surfrider. As you know, Chapter's been extremely critical of this plan. We feel the community has ample opportunities to pursue water recycling projects instead. Conservation is best. We're putting impacts on the ocean already with our ocean outfall. To dump so much water into the ocean and then to remove the salts and treat that again to use it and distribute it on the other end doesn't make much sense. I watched the Arroyo Grande City Council meeting when they discussed a similar item last week or the week before. And the mayor of Arroyo Grande, who also works for PG&E, recused himself and left on this item. So I don't know if Mayor Hill is, you know, an advocate for the project, but I'm saying that, you know, this isn't necessarily balanced here and might want to look at that. As far as distribution of the water, what staff said at that meeting was that the water would likely be distributed locally in Avila, the desalinated water, and that would make it more feasible so that you didn't have to do the, you know, opposite flow issue. But permitting wise, this is a huge, huge uphill battle. I mean, I still haven't been able to find a source that says where a community gets their water from a nuclear power plant. And also with PG&E, with the tie to their once-through cooling, that may not be around because they're now mixing their discharge with the discharge of the one-stoop cooling from the nuclear power plant. If the nuclear power plant isn't operational after 2024, there's no way to put nowhere to put all that waste. So there's all kinds of unanswered questions here. I don't see it happening by the end of next year. I know people are optimistic about it because they see it as a huge bailout on their waste because they can't manage their own resource. So thank you for hearing my comments tonight.
Thank you, Mr. Snook. Okay, let me bring this back to the council. One thing I can comment on is it is always, from what I understand, the position of this was only for the this severe drought condition. So I was really surprised to see in the staff report that the technical advisory committee was suggesting it be developed as a long-term supply. So I have no idea where that discussion came from, if there's been a discussion with PG&E. So I guess I'll wait to hear with everyone else, because that was really surprising to me. I do know that in reading his county staff reports and whatnot, that the intent was for this to be a source for just a severe drought conditions only. So that's all. Any other comments on this item?
I had a comment on if we go along with the recommendation to develop a letter of interest or formally endorsing our interest, does that commit us financially down the road, or it's just we're interested in learning more?
The intent in it would be, yeah, the answer is no.
The answer is
okay.
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 So in our staff report, it says it is uncertain at this time if the project is feasible and can provide water at a reasonable cost. Mm-hmm. So Mr. Ray's, his scenario of, you know, if we've got saltwater intrusion or whatever and we need emergency water right now, that makes sense to me if that's something we could recharge our wells with and so on. But as a regular source of water, that just doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense to me. However, I would support a saying that we have an interest in seeing where this goes, but I certainly wouldn't want to commit us in any way, shape, or form to being a part of that.
I would echo those sentiments. I think this gives us the proverbial seat at the table for discussions, and it allows us to step away from the table if it does prove to be infeasible in the future. I guess from a global perspective, realizing Mr. Snook's comments with regards to the number of unanswered questions, I think this source of water is an opportunity that didn't exist previously. Conservation, while it existed, we haven't been utilizing it. So I think this gives us an opportunity to pursue any available options. Mm-hmm. And whether it becomes a temporary solution or a permanent solution, it's an option of water, option for water. And I'll put in part of my opinion with regards to what Greg, you said earlier with regards to us actually having two water supplies. I would almost say we really only have one. It's just a matter of two different buckets. So, but it's, I mean, if
one
without
recharges the other.
Yeah, without, yeah, exactly. Without the lake, it would be groundwater type of thing. But I think having an opportunity for alternate water supplies is definitely in the community's best interest. So I'd be supportive of having the mayor sign a letter to the board.
Okay. So is someone prepared to make a motion on this item?
Sure. I recommend that let's see, that staff develop a letter for the mayor's signature to the County Board of Supervisors, the copy to the County Department of Public Works, endorsing the city's interest in the Zone 3 emergency water supply project. And may I add, maybe we might want to take a look at Pismo Beach's letter just to see how they did that.
Mr. Mayor?
Yes.
If I could, I've been listening to the discussion, and what I've heard is that the city would like to express interest and encourage the county to move the project to the next level. Ultimate support and participation by the city will be dependent on costs and water priorities of the city. The city would further encourage the county to seek grant and loan opportunities to limit cost impacts to the potential participants.
Sounds good.
I like it.
Yep. Okay. Was that your motion?
That's my motion.
I'll second.
Okay. There's no additional discussion. This is a roll call. All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
All opposed? None. Motion carries. Okay. What else do we have on our... So I think that concludes the business portion of the night. We are now going to recess into closed session. I believe we have two items, City Attorney.
Thank you, Honorable Mayor. Council will continue with the closed session items. Item 4, which is conference with legal counsel on existing litigation on Santa Maria Valley Water, and conference with real property negotiators pertaining to the leases and property acquisition on the Pacifica Companies project.
Great, thank you. And I think the Mayor Pro Tem had an announcement he wanted to make.
Yeah, just a quick announcement. So it's more of a shameless plug. So since there won't be another meeting before Giving Tuesday, which is tomorrow, and so FINS is having a fundraising opportunity for the Five Cities Homeless Coalition called Dinner for a Cause. You can go to fivechc.org to either buy tickets or show up between 5 and 9 p.m. tomorrow night at Finn's restaurant. It's for a good cause and great food. Thank you for that shameless plug.
Okay. We are recessed.